telling you, being on the book was like having an upside-down inverted pyramid right on the top of your head. A pyramid that made the Great Pyramid at Gizeh seem like a tinker toy model. They'd get you on the book, and the next thing you know, you've got a grocery bill that rivals the national debt and grows and expands, and there's a whole involved economy, almost like the national economy with armor. My mother used to go down to decide how much meat money we were going to spend for the week. It was like laying out the dough for the armament. How much for defense this week? That was when you'd buy the bread. Now what are we going to lay out for education? Education, of course, referred to things like mustard and pickles. What are we going to lay out this year for medical aid to the aged? Which made 8-hour chewing tobacco for Uncle Carl. He used to come every couple of weeks to see if he could sponge any chewing tobacco from my old man, who never chewed in his life. Old Carl would come in and say, "Got any chaw?" My father would say, "Yep." And he'd reach down into the smoking cabinet where he kept his Lucky Strikes and give Carl that old package of 8-hour day. 8-hour day is the name of a chewing tobacco. And in case those of you have never heard of chewing tobacco, it's like if you took a handful of cigarettes, took the paper off, ground it up in your hand, put a little goo in it, and maybe just a little touch of tar, maybe a little kerosene, mixed it all up, rolled it up in a ball, and stuck it back there in the motors and just started to chew. Oh, boy, that would scare him one day, wouldn't it? At the office? I mean, really, it would be wonderful to see one of these very, very nice-looking official types like Henry Cabot Lodge. Or wouldn't it be great if it got out that Nixon chewed mail pouch? He was a secret char. You know, he might get my vote if that happened. First chink in the armor. But it would be great, you know, if I could see a TV show, you know, one of these panel shows. You know, I, in case you don't know anything about chewing, one of the worst problems with chewing is the moment of truth, which always arises in chewing. And I'll tell you, I'll tell you something about my experience with chewing one time. I mean, you notice my left ear, how it hangs there like kind of loose? That was the time when I was 16 years old and I got a package of mail pouch and I stuck half of it in the back in the left there. I'd never done this in my life before. And I was working at the steel mill, and I stuck it back there in the back like I had seen all these guys down at the smelting shop. And it hangs down like a deflated basketball. Kind of hangs down. You stick it back there, and funny thing, you know, I stuck it all the way in the back there, and I'm sitting there in the bus, and we're going along, and I began to hear this high humming note. I thought we were having trouble with transmission in the bus. And it began to get higher and higher, and then it got to be a kind of a high, thin buzz. And I felt like any minute now there was some kind of an overload relay that was going to pop, and I didn't know where it was. And suddenly it popped all over the floor. Oh, fantastic. Oh, fantastic. Oh, I sweat. Oh, have you ever been so sick to your stomach that you just pop out and it's so much sweat? I mean, sweat just pours off of you like gigantic, great drops drip down on your nose. Oh, I'm getting sick thinking of it now. Hold on a minute. Oh. There. Whew. Oh, boy. Oh. It would be a great television show, though. Just an immense TV show. Here we got Lawrence Spivak, you see. Lawrence Spivak is looking angry, and he's always saying, "Sir, I'd like to ask you about the proposal you made regarding the Peruvian." There's Lawrence Spivak. And over here is Martha Roundtree. And here's a kind of a fat lady wearing a flowered hat who writes for one of the Atlanta newspaper chains. She's sitting there. And right in the middle of it all is sitting Henry Cabot Lodge. And the program is called Meet the Important People. And it comes on, see? great picture. I could see it. On comes the theme, see? You hear... First of all, it says a CBS public service production. And you see the White House slowly drifting past. And then there's that stylized drawing of the Capitol Dome. A prize-winning program. Peabody Award winner. Of course, it's on 3 o'clock Sunday a.m. as the time all prize-winning shows are on. And then there's always the MC of these shows, who is kind of a well-scrubbed-looking type, who reminds you roughly of a, let's say, of a sensible Bergen Evans. It's hard to imagine, but you know the type. And he looks out at you and he says, good afternoon. Welcome to Meet the Important People. Today we are going to discuss on our roundtable discussion the importance of being important in today's important world conflictual problems. And our guest this afternoon is Henry Cabot Lodge, an important person. And the camera dollies over there. And you see Cabot Lodge. He goes, looks at you, doesn't say anything. He just sort of grins with his mouth shut. And one of our panel members today is Martha Roundtree. Hi, y'all. She looks out at you, that slightly bug-eyed look. And then they dolly over, and there is Mrs. Amelia Watanabe, who is the ace reporter for the Atlanta Journal chain of newspapers. She looks out at you, you know, that funny little look. They're all a little nervous in the beginning, you know. And there, of course, is our regular member, our regular panel member, Lawrence Spivak. He looks out at you with that angry smile. He's a literate Mort Saul. He looks out at you with an angry smile. And then he says, all right, now, let's begin the questioning now. All righty, folks, now, let's begin with you, Lawrence. And Lawrence says, Mr. Lodge, since you have left the United Nations, there have been many changes in the world situation. And we would like to ask, first of all, what are you covering up for? Lodge says, well, well, that's a good question. Mr. Spivak, I feel that my record stands for itself. Yes, all right, that's an excellent question. All right, and now what about you, Miss Roundtree?
Well, Mr. Lodge, I've been wondering what it is about you that makes the voters of the Midwest, they kind of like you.
This time he answers with his mouth shut. He nods a little bit. And it goes on for 10 minutes like that. But each time as we pick up Mr. Lodge, there are beads of sweat beginning to form on his forehead. And suddenly, just as Lawrence Spivak says, and now, Mr. Lodge, you haven't said much during this program. I'd like to put a point-blank yes or no question to you. No. Just a minute now. I'm going to keep you right to the point. I'm going to ask you, and suddenly, the camera picks up Henry Cabot Lodge. He leaps up out of his chair. He rushes off screen, and 30 seconds later, he comes back, and he looks very smiling. Sits down. Perspiration. Now he speaks fluently. Just goes right along and answers all the questions and answers them well. He got caught in the moment of truth. All there was to it, just a moment of truth. And so I saw this moment of truth today, in case you're interested in the moment of truth. Sorry, madam, I shouldn't have brought it up at this time.
What's this young man speaking about?
Well, I've often wondered what we're any of us speaking about. You see, one thing I've learned. I have learned that we are living in the midst of the most completely wild, the most beautifully, inconceivably conceived vaudeville show. That, well, we can't even, you know, you don't know whether you're coming after the seal axe, you don't know whether you're playing after the dog axe, or you don't know, maybe you might even be the seal axe, you know? Get off my back. I said, get off my back. Okay? Right. And so I'm watching television today, and I see a moment of truth. Here is this center fielder out there. A beautiful moment. And I think it was Roger Maris or somebody. He had a little fly ball. Just one of these little nubbers. It just sails up, and it was a soft, mushy click. It wasn't a hard one, just like that. And he caught it. Right on the fat part of the bat, but he caught it in a twisting going away. And so he just pushed it up. and just was rising as it went out of her second base. Just a soft, easy, what they call it, just a soft, easy humpback liner. Just raising up there. And the center fielder was playing him short, of all things. Out of position already. And so, the camera's on him. He starts to run. And the ball is, obviously, it's an easy out. And suddenly there's a little scurrying out there, a little shuffling around. And the next thing I knew, the center fielder is reclining. The ball is bouncing. He grabs it. And Maris pulls up with a base hit. It wasn't an error. It was a base hit. And so the announcer, I think it was Red Barber at this point, he says, you know what he did there? He started after the ball. And just when he was about to grab the ball, he flipped his sunglasses down. You know, there's an old baseball axiom that either you put your sunglasses down before you run after the ball or you don't put them down at all. He got caught in midstream with his sunglasses down. I might coin a phrase, Mal. It's difficult to explain what that phrase means to you, Mal, in your present overwrought condition. But I'm sitting there and I says, that's just like all of us. We start out at a heavy gallop. And just about the time we get going, roughly, we begin to feel that we're losing change from our hip pocket. It's beginning to jiggle up and out. We start reaching down into our hip pocket, hoping that we can do something about it. Our sunglasses are jiggling up and down. The ball is spinning down. No, no. You're just trying? All right, madam, I'm going to ask you this now. Just hold it there in abeyance. I'm going to ask you this. Would you have believed it if I told you that they are now? I guess you might. Well, let's put it another way. Would you believe that there is a company that has spent millions of dollars, endless hours in the laboratories? You know, they're always showing these laboratories in these cosmetic joints on the TV commercials. There's this one where all these serious-looking people are standing around, and you suspect they're inventing a new nuclear fission weapon. You see all kinds of titrations going on up and down, and the next thing I know, Barbara Britton is stepping up to the front there wearing a white coat. I can't imagine what they're concocting with Barbara Britton at the head of the experiments.
Hello, ladies. This is Barbara Britton speaking to you from our important laboratory.
And you could... they're concocting another in. Would you believe that there is a company that has spent countless dollars and countless hours in the laboratory to produce an odorless fertilizer? And then, once they have produced the odorless fertilizer, and it goes out, you know what fertilizer is, baby. It goes out on the market, it gets out there, and it's going pretty good, you know? And then somebody realizes that it should be selling better. So they spend another $4 million, another 8,000 hours in the laboratory, and they institute a synthetic barnyard odor in the fertilizer. And sales have gone up 200%.
You know, Gene,
speaking of fertilizer...
How can you follow that? Speaking of broadcast licenses, this is WOR Radio, your station for news. WOR 710 and WOR FM New York.
You missed my point, Phil.
Owned and operated by RKO General.
Rich, verdant soil. I mean,
I got the point, right?
Heavy, heavy, beautiful, growing things. And, you know, I mean, it's the blood of life. I mean, the blood of... The life of all right, I'll go. It's the blood of life, the life of blood. Do your commercial.
May I venture a commercial here? No, actually, did you know that fertilizer was sold on the air? I did some commercials.
Yes, I know.
On the West Coast for it. Where the very, very, very sexy girl says... something like this. The word is, and the sponsor's name, for steer manure. And they have a jingle and a wonderful commercial to sell this product to farmers. It was on the West Coast and in the South. Of course, after we laughed for 2 hours, we recorded these things.
But the thing was done very seriously, and the client was very, very, very serious about it.
Well, that isn't... that's open selling of fertilizer. I'm speaking of the fertilizer we sell all day long that we don't plant. That's another kind.
I can't follow that either.
Once again, we return to... You know, when I read that, I just could not believe it. You know, we have a terrible nostalgia today for real things. We really do. I mean, real things. You know, things that are primeval, things that are eternal. We really do. We live in this world of plastic seat covers, plastic people. We live in a plywood world. Billy Rose's famous line, "It's only a cardboard moon." Well, it's a cardboard world we live in today, where almost everything... You know, I understand now, after really looking at this thing, at least this is my theory about it, why people can hardly today get excited over anything that really is happening in the world. Because it seems to be all part of a play. Castro seems to be an interesting sort of situation that's developing in the drama, you know? It seems to be part of a TV show sort of thing. There's an unreal quality to the attitudes about the world situation. And interestingly enough, you know, I find that it is even more prevalent in the business of communications, the world of supposedly exposing you to what the world is about. You know, many, many years ago, when they came out with, when radio first began to be an operating thing, and when television was a gleam in a couple of guys' eyes back in the 1920s, the idea about television, the idea about radio was that countless people would now, we were entering a period of unparalleled peace, because there was the old idea that if there was communications between people, there would be peace. Do you recall anybody saying things like this, Jerry? And I'm not speaking of that period. It's been said many times over and over that if there were communications, if people could communicate, there would be no misunderstandings. Well, as a matter of fact, as history has unfolded, it has gone precisely the opposite. That countless peoples used to feel 100 years ago that basically there was many an area of good in other people. And if you read the journals of the travelers of, let's say, the 1820s and the 1830s, their attitudes towards other peoples were completely different from the attitudes of a traveler today, who generally goes out to look for things that he can find to back up and to bolster the various biases that he has about the people he sees. For example, if a New York journalist travels through the South, he only writes about racial segregation or desegregation, or hate of one kind or another. If a Russian travels in America, he writes in Pravda about the decadence in American life. If an American travels in Russia, he writes about the monolithic state where the individual is crushed and so on. You know, the stuff you get all the time. Well, I'm not saying it isn't true. I'm merely saying this is all we ever seem to write about these days, or talk about. And now, what has communications got to do with this? Well, radio has done this. Television has brought it, countless hours of essays and one-hour programs about these various countries. And almost always, there is this underlying feeling about it. Let us go out and look for these things that we set out to look for. Let's find them. Let's make a big thing about them. And this is just one aspect of it. But it's interesting to note that the business of communication, I have found, within the area of communications, all the people I've known who've worked in television, radio, are some of the most insular people I've ever known, too. Insular. By insular, I mean there is a deep concern with their business, a deep concern with world affairs, but almost always, in many cases, as a means of a show. I've found this happening many times. But wouldn't it be great to go down and do a show in Havana?
Wow.
This kind of thing. Let's put on a show. This sort of thing. And it gets to be a point where there... I'm sorry. This is my opinion. Get your own show. Give yours. That the intriguing thing about it is there's nothing wrong with it because our whole world is like that now. I'm not saying that this is no fault of the radio or television business. That who among the people really look at anything as though it's real, but not more nor less than an extension of a kind of show. And so a guy will sit there and he'll look at 1 hour of the, let's say, the Middle Eastern problem. He'll feel like somehow he's settled it by watching a one-hour show. He's done something about it. You know, he's made his step. And then the next thing, he's watching the Ed Sullivan Show. And it all sort of unreels, it unreels, and it unreels. Until finally we get to the point in our communication world where if you go across the dial, fascinating thing to see in the middle of the 20th century, I have a feeling that a historian, maybe 500 or 600 years from now, would be very, very intrigued by looking at a digest of the average television show or the average radio show that was heard by the average person in the United States during this most crucial period in our history. I think the composite television show would be a guy walking down a western street meeting Bert Parks at the other end about to award a prize to somebody in the bar. I mean, this would be a composite, you know, a digest. That would be the average. And let's face it, I'm talking about the average. The average radio show, if you went right across the dial, I can't even, this great cacophony of teenage songs with a guy shrieking the time every 30 seconds, somebody giving you the weather every 2.5 minutes, and a 5-minute capsule of headlines. Yeah, this would be the average show heard today. Now, these are the communications that we speak of as bringing people closer together, whereas actually they've isolated people, I feel, more than they've brought them together. And this is, again, I have to bring in the disclaimer, this is not an editorial against radio or television, not at all. I'm just saying it's I think, a basic thing within us. All of these things spring out of us, you know, everybody. We like to, you know, there's an old idea, the old philosophy of the we and they, which has been exploited by many people over the past 15,000 years or more. It's exploited by nightclub comics as well as by dictators. It's exploited by people who write books as well as people who publish magazines. The we-they theory holds something like this, that it is granted that there are things wrong with the world, terrible things wrong with the world, but we are the alert, bright people who feel that something should be done about it. They are the people who are doing it to us. Now, the they might be another country. If, generally speaking, in other countries, they point the they out as being us now. We are the they to many people in the world. And strangely enough, in America, generally when we speak of they, we usually refer to the people who are running the government at any given time. They're the they. We hardly ever refer to any other country as the ineffable they. But this changes. This shifts back and forth. We're just having our day in the sun. And the we-they thing is a very convenient thing because it takes a lot of people off the hook, particularly the people who feel good, clean, bright, and who feel that they're doing something about it by blaming it on the they. You see? this is accomplishing something. And as our world gets more and more into a state of turmoil. Have you noticed that demonstrations, I can recall doing a show, I don't know what it is, I think doing this kind of, this sort of inverse analysis, peering down into those limbo areas of the soul, which I do perforce because it happens to be my profession, and most people never get a chance to do it. How long has it been since you've sat down for 4 hours straight and just thought about what you really think about things? Without once picking up a newspaper, without once looking at a television set, without once talking to anybody else. I mean, just sat down for 4 hours and thought. Well, this happens to be what I do. I do this 6 hours a week. And it's odd how many things come up out of the dredgings down in the mind. Things which I am not aware of and things which I did not become knowledgeable about until they suddenly popped out. You know, there they were. And they obviously came out of me, you know. And sometimes I'm aghast at what it is. Other times I'm amused. More often than that. I mean, more often amused than not, you know. And so we sit here and I'm looking down into the mind and about, gee, it must have been 1955, something like that. About 5 years ago, I was doing an all-night radio program here at WOR. Maybe some of you remember it. And I had a news ticker out there, and I was out, there was a record on or something, and I went out and I looked at the news ticker, and there was a story about a student demonstration in Cairo. I remember this. It said a student demonstration in Cairo. Well, I came back on the air maybe 10 or 15 minutes later, and I was thinking about this. And I did a whole thing then, a whole essay on the fact, not the fact, but the thesis, the idea that the demonstration was almost a thing of the past and that we're constantly reading about demonstrations somewhere. There's always a demonstration by some student group in Iran, something of this nature. They have a kind of strange, unreal air about them. Who are these demonstrators, you know, these students that are always leaping up with signs? And I made a big thing about that, and I said at that time that the demonstration was a thing which had hardly ever really been seen in America, a demonstration. And then I went on to say, and this is one of those strange, let's say almost a premonition, I said that I think we are heading into a period when the demonstration will become almost a way of life. And I left it hang out there in the air. Now, I don't know why I said this, what made me think it. I just had a feeling. It's funny what kind of feelings you'll get at 4 o'clock in the morning. Have you ever wakened yourself up sometime at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning? You're standing in the kitchen and the shade is banging up against the Venetian blind and the refrigerator is going. And you're standing there on the cold floor and you begin to have these thoughts. Once, you know, you sit down and maybe you smoke a cigarette and you drink a cup of rancid coffee that's been on the... By the way, nothing brings out those thoughts more than coffee that's been on the stove for 4 days. And you heat it up for the last time, put a little water in it, and by now it's at the spooning stage. It has a thin green growth over the top of it. And you pour it into the cup and it goes glup, glup, glup. And it glups down into the cup, and you spoon it up a little bit, and you sup. You sip in a little of this stuff, and your eyeballs redden, glow in the dark like coals. And you light this butt of a cigarette that you find in the ashtray, and you hear the rattle of that torn blind against the window as that clammy breeze comes in off of New Jersey, off of Weehawken. And you just sit there, you know, and slowly but surely these things begin to drift in front of your mind. And then you start going, and you go back to bed and you don't think any more about it. And then suddenly you find yourself in the position 2 years later of looking at that in the flesh that you thought of in that dark kitchen many eons before. Well, this is a current thing. Yes, it happened. So at 4 o'clock in the morning 5 years ago, I said the day was going to come when the demonstration will be the way of life. And I didn't think it was possible. And so I picked up the Times a couple of days ago, and I'm sitting there in the H&H, and I had forgotten about this little thing that drifted before me at 4 o'clock in the morning when I was spooning in that black rancid coffee and smoking the butt of an ancient cigarette found underneath a sofa somewhere. Doing this eternal radio show, and I was looking through the Times, and here was a demonstration in the Congo, a demonstration here, and I'm going through demonstration, until finally I got to the back page there where they were having the obituaries, and I expected a demonstration to rise out of there, but most of those guys just missed, and I put the paper down, and I thought, gee, that's funny. Not that they were having demonstrations. And then that thing began to slowly come out in front of me, that little image that I'd had in 1955. I said, you know, one of those things. And I understand what Hieronymus Bosch was talking about, you know, and Ambrose Bierce, too. And you begin to understand these things, and you say, well, look, you can't go too far.
Your imagination, you just can't possibly go too far, because if you do, well, you can't go too far. Get me that guitar. Get me that guitar. You just can't go too far, because if you... it's impossible. Go as far as you can, and you will find in 10 minutes it will catch up with you. Within 10 minutes, I will say. If not 10 minutes, at least maybe 3 weeks. And once it has caught up with you, I mean, there's just no going back. And then you have to go further out again. Until finally the world of the imagination becomes the world of the real. And once it becomes the world of the real, I mean, you have to go further out than that even. Let me tell you about this. I want to tell you about a man. Listen, I mean, don't push and shove. Just stand back now. Don't kick the fire. But this fire is very important to us. I mean, don't put the flame out. It's extremely important. I want to tell you about somebody. You see, countless centuries ago, the storyteller was the most important man in the community because he preserved the traditions. He told the people what had happened to people who came before them and what happened to people just beyond the next hill that they couldn't see. And that was important. He then, as he neared the end of his story, he always drew a conclusion, which is the most important part of a story. A story without a conclusion is no story at all. And I'm not speaking of an end. I'm speaking of a conclusion. You see, it's as though the author, as he nears the last paragraph, or maybe the last chapter, just let her go, Jerry. As he nears the last chapter, he says, "You know, it's a funny story, isn't it? What I've told you. And this is why I told it to you. This is what it means to me." And then he lays it down. Like George Ade would say once in a while at the end of a story. Moral. Don't try to figure out a thing. That's precisely what he meant. And so here I sit on my duff, surrounded by seven of the faithful, and the only thing you're faithful about is the only thing I'm faithful about. And I'm not speaking of faithful listeners. We're human beings. That's all. We are faithful to that. You are alive, I am alive. You have resisted becoming a turtle, so have I. Well, others have, that is true. And so we've resisted it, haven't we? Have you ever had the feeling that you are a turtle and someone has carved an obscene word on your back? With a penknife? And a date? Excuse me, madam. Of course, not you. I'm not referring to you, madam. Not such a lovely, pristine, right-thinking creature as you. Of course not. And so as you sit here, you know, around the old fire, and I'm chewing the fat, trying to keep up the little embers once in a while, it's quite true that the fire burns low from time to time, and there just ain't many stories to tell sometimes. But on the other hand, there are so many that no one can possibly understand all of them or tell even one-tenth of them. Right? You know what I mean? Of course you do. And there's no way to go but there. And a guy comes up to me and says, "Shepherd, what are you trying to do? What is the underlying theme of your show?" I turn to him and I say, "What's the underlying theme of your show, Mac?" He said, "What do you mean? I don't have a show." I said, "Oh, no? Oh." It's the underlying theme that we all got. But none of us understand. And so countless ages ago, a man would sit in the campfire and he would tell. Just sit there. Everyone would sit around. He'd say, "There was once a man, you know, who lived right here in this very valley. And he was a big man.
more ways than one. He had a wife and a child. And he used to dream strange dreams. Do you want to hear the rest of the story? You see, you can't resist the storyteller. You just can't resist the storyteller. Because the storyteller brings it all into focus, and that's why you can't resist it, because it's not in focus. It's his job to bring it all together, you know, and make it into a pyramid instead of a great big lump of putty. That's why the pyramid is such a pleasing shape. Because it has meaning, you know. Rises to a point. Do you want me to tell you a story that was told to me by another man? Okay. Listen to this story now. It's about a man. Just a man. And he was a man who lived in New York. An ordinary-looking man. You listen to this now. All of you, listen. This is important. It's a story about a man. I want you to listen to this now. When he wasn't tending his New York holdings, Guy Grand, that was his name, was generally, as he expressed it, on the go. Just on the go. He took cross-country trips by train, New York to Miami, Miami to Seattle, that sort of thing. Always on a slow train, one that made frequent stops. How long has it been since you've ridden on a slow train? There's hardly anything more. You know, a train ride from here to Seattle would excite me 50 times more than a jet trip to Austria. Really, a slow train ride. There's nothing like a slow train ride. Get on that old train, you know, and you sit there. You look out of the window. Oh, that's because you're a kid. That's why you don't dig it yet. All kids dig rockets and things when they're kids. You grow out of that. You do, you know. There's hardly anything more pleasant than sitting on your old duff in the train, you know, and they button her up, and she slowly pulls out of the station and begins to move. Oh, that's a great feeling. And especially when you got a long trip ahead of you, you know. You got a couple of books. Maybe there's a chick there even. Maybe even not. It doesn't matter. There's the train, and there's the distance. You walk down the aisle, you go into the club car. Or maybe you don't. Maybe you just walk and you look out of the window. You know, the one thing I know about the people of Europe, they know how to travel on a train. They love trains. And they have beautiful trains. Well, Guy Grand was the kind of guy who liked a long train ride that made frequent stops. Now, accommodations on these trains is limited, you know. Nothing fancy. And even though he engaged the best, Grand often was satisfied with the small compartment fitted with scarcely more than the essentials of comfort. But he accepted this cheerfully. And so today, as we see him, picture him. Today, on a summer afternoon, just like today, at precisely 2:05, with a buoyant step, considering his girth, he was 53, and he had a big, round, fat thing hanging out there in front of him. He climbed aboard the first Pullman car of the Portland Plower. He found his compartment. He settled down for the pleasant routine of the long, slow journey to New York. Is that pleasant? As was his habit, he immediately rang the porter to bring around a large bottle of Campari. You know what is it, Campari? An Italian aperitif? He ordered a bottle of Campari and a bottle of finely iced water and then sat down at his desk to write business letters. It was known that for any personal service, Grand was inclined to tip generously. And because of this, there were usually three or four porters loitering in the corridor nearby. They kept a sharp eye on the compartment door in case Grand should signal some need or other, and as the train pulled out of the station, they could hear him moving about inside, humming to himself, and shuffling papers to and fro on his desk. Stir up the fire there a little bit. There. Wet my whistle a little, Remind me to tell you about how Uncle Carl used to use the phrase wet my whistle a little. Remind me of that, will you? You want to hear more about Mr. Grand and what he did? Well, before the train made its first stop, orders were that the porters should not be seen when he came out of his compartment. The porters had to clear out before he came out of his compartment, before he hit the first stop. And he did come out at every stop, out of his compartment. Now, at the first of these stops, now listen carefully now, this is very important. I know it's starting out rather dully. We're all little children, but listen carefully. You are in for a surprisey. At the first of these stops, which was not long in occurring, Mr. Grand went quickly to the adjoining day coach and took a seat by the window. There he was able to lean out and to observe the activity on the platform. He attracted little attention himself, resembling, as he did, with his pleasant red face, any honest farmer. From the train station, one could see over and beyond the station, from the train window, one could see the rest of the small New England town, motionless now, in the summer afternoon, like a toy mausoleum. Just sitting there in the sun, while all that seemed to live within the town was being skillfully whipped underground and funneled up again in swift urgency up onto the station platform, where small square cartons were unloaded from a central car. But amidst the confusion and haste on the platform, there was one recognizable figure. This was the man who sold hot dogs. He sold them from a big box that he carried strapped to his neck. "Red hot! Red hot! Red hot!" he cried repeatedly as he walked up and down parallel to the train and just a foot from it, while Mr. Grand, after a minute of general observation, focused all of his attention on this person. And then, at exactly 1 minute before his departure, he began his case with the hot dog man. "Red hot! Hey, red hot!" he shouted. He called out, "Hey, red hot!" When the man reached the window, Grand looked at him shrewdly for a second, squinting a little bit as though appraising his character, before he asked, tight-lipped, "How much?" 20 cents, the hot dog man said hurriedly. The train was just about getting ready to pull out. 20 cents, mustard and relish. They're red hot, 20 cents. Done, said Grand with a sober nod. And as the train actually began to move forward and the hot dog man began to walk rapidly in keeping abreast of the train window, Guy Grand leaned out of the window and handed him a $500 bill. "Break this," he said tersely. The hot dog man, in trying to utilize all the remaining time, passed the hot dog to Grand. He handed the hot dog over and reached into his change pocket before having looked carefully at the bill, so that by the time he made out its denomination, he was running full tilt alongside the train, grimacing oddly and shaking his head, trying to return the bill with one hand and to recover the hot dog from Grand with the other. During their final second together, with the hot dog man's last overwhelming effort to reach his outstretched hand, Grand reached into his own coat pocket and took out a colorful plastic animal mask. A plastic animal mask. Today, it was that of a pig. He is wearing a pig mask, looking out at the hot dog man. He quickly donned it before beginning to gorge the hot dog through the round mouth of the mask, stuffing it in as he did so, at the same time reaching out frantically for the $500 bill, yet managing to keep just out of grasp of the man's hand. The train was moving faster and faster, and continuing all this while, the distance lengthened gradually, hopelessly, until at last the hot dog man stood exhausted at the end of the platform, still holding the $500 bill and staring after the vanishing train. When Mr. Grand finally drew himself back from the window, doffed his pig mask, He looked across to face a middle-aged woman across the aisle who was twisted halfway around in her seat, observing Grand with a curiosity so intense that the instant of their eyes actually meeting did not seem to register at all with her. She coughed, glanced away. But irresistibly, she looked back again as Guy Grand rose, all smiles on his farmer's face, to leave the day coach. And as he did, he gave the woman a wink of affectionate conspiracy. Just having a little laugh with that hot dog vendor. He explained, no real harm done, actually. He returned to his compartment, and he sat at his desk, sipping his Campari, a drink the color of raspberries, but as bitter as gall. And he speculated about the possible reactions of the hot dog man. Outside the compartment, even at the far end of the corridor, the idle porters could often hear his odd chortle as he stirred about alone. Inside. By the time the train reached New York, Guy Grand had gone through this little performance at least five times. Curious fellow. Stop. Speaking of curious fellows, this is WORAM and FM New York. We'll be here until 1 o'clock in the morning. You want to hear more about Mr. Grand? Huh? Does he bother you? All right, I'll tell you one more little thing about Mr. Grand. Out of the gray granite morass of Wall Street rises one building like a heron of fire, soaring up in blue-white astonishment. Number 18 Wall, a rocket of glass and blinding copper. It is the Grand Investment Building, perhaps the most contemporary business structure in our country, known in circles of high finance simply as Grand's. Now, the offices of Grand's are occupied by companies which deal in mutual funds, giant and fantastic corporations whose policies define the shape of nations. August Guy Grand himself was a billionaire. He had $180 million in cash deposit in New York banks. And this ready capital was, of course, just a small part of his gross holdings. In the beginning, Grand's associates, wealthy men themselves, saw nothing extraordinary about him. A reticent man of simple tastes, they thought, a man who had inherited most of his money and had preserved it through large safe investments in steel, rubber, and oil. When his associates managed to see a little bit beyond Mr. Grand, all they saw was a reflection of their own dullness, a club member, a dinner guest, a possibility, a threat, a man whose holdings represented a prospect and a danger. But this was to do injustice to Grand's private life, because his private life was completely atypical. For one thing, he was the last of the big spenders. And for another, he had a very unusual attitude towards people. Now, listen to this. Now, come on, don't drift away. He had a very unusual attitude towards people. He spent about $10 million a year in, as he expressed it, making it hot for him. At 53... Grand had a thick trunk and a large, balding bullet head. His face was pink, so that in certain half-lights, he looked like a fat, radish man. Although not displeasingly so, for he always sported well-cut clothing, and near his throat, a diamond, the size of a nickel. A diamond now, at this very moment, that caught the late afternoon sun in a soft spangle of burning color, when Guy stepped through the soundless doors of Grand's. And into the blue haze of the almost empty street, past the huge doorman appearing larger than life in gigantic livery, he who touched his cap with quick but easy reverence. Cab, Mr. Grand. Cab, Mr. Grand. Thank you, no, Jason, said Guy. I have the car today. And with a pleasant smile for the man, he turned adroitly on his heel, turned north, and walked toward Worth Street. Guy Grand's gait was brisk indeed. Small, sharp steps rising on the toes. It was the gait of a man who appears to be snapping his fingers as he walks. Half a block on, he reached his car. You get the picture now? He reached his car. And he had a little difficulty in recognizing it at first because beneath the windshield wiper lay a big parking ticket, which Grand slowly withdrew, regarding it curiously.
Looks like you got a ticket, bub, said a voice somewhere behind him.
Out of the corner of his eye, Grand perceived the man in a dark summer suit leaning idly against the side of the building near his car. There was something terse and smug in the tone of his remark, a sort of nasal piousness. Yes, so it seems, mused Mr. Grand, without looking up, continuing to study the ticket in his hand. How much will you eat it for? He asked then, raising a piercing smile at the man.
How's that, mister?
Demanded the man with a nasty frown, pushing himself forward a little bit from the building. Grand cleared his throat and slowly took out his wallet. It was a wallet of such fine leather, a long, slender wallet, that it would have been as limp as silk had it not been so chock full of thousands. I ask you, what would you take to eat it? You know, eat it? Wide-eyed, he made a great chewing motion with his mouth. No, eat it? Holding the ticket up near his mouth to demonstrate. The man, glaring a bit, took a tentative step forward. Say, I don't get you, bud. I don't get you, mister. Well, drawled Mr. Grand, chuckling down at his fat wallet, browsing about in it for a moment. Simple enough, really. Let's see. He took out a few $1,000. I have this ticket, as you know. And I was just wondering if you would care to eat it. For, say, $6,000. What do you mean, eat it? Demanded the dark-suited man in a kind of snarl. What are you anyway, bud, a wise guy? Wise guy, call me anything you like. As long as you don't call me late for chow. Grand rounded off what he had to say with an easy chortle. But then he snapped quickly to attention and unsmiling he said, how about it, pal? You got a taste for the easy green? How about it? The man, who now appeared to be openly angry, took another step forward. Listen, buddy. He began in a threatening tone, half clenching his fists. I think I should warn you, Grand said quietly, raising one hand to his breast. I think I should warn you that I am armed. Huh? The man seemed momentarily dumbfounded, staring down in dull rage at the bills in Grand's hand. Then he partially recovered. Cocking his head to one side, he regarded Grand narrowly in an attempt at shrewd country skepticism, still heavily flavored with indignation. And just who do you think you are, mister? Just what is your game, huh? What is your game? Grand's the name. Easy Green's the game, said Grand with a little twinkle. Would you care to play along, Play along, eh? He brusquely, at this point, flicked the corners of the six crisp $1,000 bills, and they crackled with a brittle, compelling sound. Listen here, you.
muttered the man, tight-lipped, flexing his fingers and exhaling several times in angry exasperation. Now, listen here. Are you trying to tell me that you're going to give me $6,000 to eat that? He pointed stiffly at the ticket in Guy's hand. To eat that ticket? There was a pause. That is about the size of it, said Grand. At this point, he glanced at his watch. It's what you might call a limited offer. Limited, that is. Let's say expiring in 1 minute. 60 seconds, 1 minute, eh? Now, listen, mister. Listen, you, said the man between clenched teeth. If this is a gag, buddy, so help me. He shook his head to show how serious he was. If this is a gag... No threats. No threats, or I will shoot you in the temple. Well, what do you say? 48 seconds remaining. 47 now. Let's see that dough, exclaimed the man, quite beside himself now, grabbing at the bills. Grand allowed him to examine them as he continued to regard his watch. 39 seconds remaining. Shall I start the big countdown now? The big countdown? Without waiting for the latter's reply, he stepped back about 2 paces, cupping his hands like a megaphone. He began dramatically intoning, 28, 27, 26. While the man made several wildly gesticulated and incoherent remarks before seizing the ticket, ripping off a quarter of it with his teeth, and beginning to chew, eyes blazing. He's beginning to chew. Stout fellow, stout fellow, cried Grand warmly, breaking off the countdown to step forward and give the chap a hearty clap on the shoulder and hand him the $6,000. Oh, come on, you don't have to actually eat the ticket, he explained. I was just curious to see if you had your price. He gave a wink and a tolerant chuckle. Most of us have, I suppose, eh? Yes. And with a grand wave of his hand, he stepped inside his car and sped away, leaving the man in the dark summer suit standing on the sidewalk, staring after him, fairly agog.
Goodbye, blues. I've got glasses on and
I keep seeing that pig mask. In case you're interested, and I think you are. You know, it's a funny thing. This was a reading from a book, and the book is a book entitled "The Magic Christian." The Magic Christian, and that was written by Terry Southern, and is one of the funniest books I've read in a long time. The Magic Christian by Terry Southern, and if Mr. Southern is listening, or any of his friends are listening, he writes real good. I've never run into his work before, but he writes with a strange directness and yet a complete indirectness that reminds me a great deal of, I was constantly being reminded of somebody, and even though in the dust jacket they mention Nathaniel West, there is some of that, but that is not really. I can't think who it is yet. Well, I'll come up with it. Not that he copies him, but there's somebody whom he reminds me of. And can't think. It's been bugging me, you know. It's like having a song hanging around in your mind, and you're trying to get it out of there. And since I've read him, I have somebody hanging around in the outskirts of my mind who he reminds me of, and it's not anyone particularly well known. There is a great element of Nathaniel West in his work, though. Very funny man. Terribly tearing satire. Speaking of satire, a woman just called, and she says, what is this guy doing with this satire? What's bothering him? What is he doing the satire for? What's bothering him? And it's a very interesting question. It's not to be dismissed so lightly. It always fascinates me when I see how troubled people get when someone does not accept most of everything in life without a whimper. You know? Have you noticed that? I think one of the big things that separates the generation today from I'm talking about the generation of youngsters in 15, 16 age group, 17 maybe, what separates them from the older people is that they are apparently having a harder time. From what I can ascertain, they are having a more difficult time accepting the inanities of life without a whimper than generations before them. And somehow, it seems that they have been given some sort of insight that they can see it. Now, I'm not one of these people who has this great belief that children see the world the way it is. All that jazz that you're constantly being given to by the romantics. And then if you ask the guy who is saying that, well, did you see it the way it was when you were a kid? And he said, well, yes, actually. Oh, come on now. What'd you do, forget about it then as you grow up or what? No, I don't think that it is true that children can see the world any clearer than adults. But I will say this. They see it, obviously, from a different perspective. It's not that it's a clearer one. It's that it's certainly a different side. And since the images and the pictures that we have created, that the world has created as a way of life, as the conventions of living, have become increasingly less operative, you know, in this great world, this rising technology, I don't think anybody sitting around here tonight, anybody listening tonight, will even be able to remotely predict what life will be here in the United States 150 years from now. And we usually take the easy way out, you know. I notice that most people, when they predict what things are going to be like 150 years from now, content themselves with predicting in the general direction of technology. They will predict about this machine will do that, that machine will do this. They hardly ever predict what people are going to feel like 150 years from now. They hardly dare to predict what sort of depression will rage or what sort of wild passion will rage among people 150 years from now. I'm sure that as long as you remind me about Uncle Carl and what he said about that. I remember Uncle Carl one night. And this is one of those images that kids retain, you know. And I am not bringing this up because I'm nostalgic about the old days in any sense of the word. Nothing to do with nostalgia. I have to always add that disclaimer because immediately somebody will call, "Tell Mr. Shovel to talk about penny candy." I don't give a fiddler's you-know-what for penny candy. It's terrible candy. I'm here to talk about the slow process of drowning that is life. I remember Uncle Carl coming to the house one Saturday night. It was one of those Saturday nights which he had spent his relief check in 15 minutes at a place called Fred's in the middle of the block, where everyone spent their relief checks, apparently, who were of his particular stripe, in 15 minutes, listening to the White Sox ball game. Well, I remember Uncle Carl arriving to the house one day. He arrived up on the front porch, squiffed to the ears. And, you know, kids are fascinated about these things. They're intrigued. One of the great sports among many kids, that's the same one.
Will you tell Mr. Shepard that I'm going back to WQXR?
That's where you belong, baby. So, anyway, he arrived, you know, just squishing every way. And I'll tell you, I'm going to have to give you a terrible admission, an awful admission that we had. I must make this. There are a thousand things back in your mind, way in the background in your mind. I don't care who you are. Things that you performed, acts that you carried through, situations that you were part of, that you would never, you can't even admit. You just won't admit them. And generally, even though you don't admit them, quite often you don't remember them because it's convenient not to. Your mind is not only intriguing in many ways, it's intriguing in one special way, and that is it's very convenient. The mind has a self-editing work that it's cut out for itself, and it edits out the unpleasant things quite often until finally you can arrive at a point where the world is totally pleasant. There's no problems anywhere, and you get to that point where like the National Republican Committee woman I heard the other day when a man said to her on the air, I was listening to her, it was a wonderful little moment there, a moment of that complete editing out. And the man was interviewing her, and he said, well, what does your candidate propose to do about the situation in the Congo?
She says, well, I feel that I'm glad you asked that question. Now, that situation, I feel, is a situation that will call for additional understanding. It will call for concern on the part of the leaders of our country, and I also say that it will actually probably involve some sort of material help.
Gewalt. And so, it's this kind of self-editing. Well, the problem is this, you know, that these things still remain in our mind. Whether they're edited out, they're not thrown away. They're put into a separate drawer that says edited material. And that drawer is a very, very difficult drawer. Even though you put locks and bolts on it, you keep hearing those shrieks and moans that come out of there once in a while, and occasional thumpings from fist fights going on in there, and those old events are still being played out, slugging it out there in the dark in that file cabinet that's locked. Well, I'll tell you, I just pulled one of those out 30 seconds ago, and I'm, for those of you who are, well, the women and children, just please don't listen to this. When I was but a wee stripling, it came to pass that on the south side of Chicago, you know, children have a wonderful, blasé, and at the same time open view of things which they, you know, as you grow older, you turn away from things. You don't really observe them because you know too much about them or you think you do. You turn away. And it's a common, it's like when you see too many beggars on the street, you turn away from beggars. You don't see them. You see them, and then you don't see them, you know. You turn away from them. They're unpleasant things, very unpleasant moments when somebody clutches at your coat collar or at your elbow, you know, and makes those squeaking sounds. It's a very unpleasant moment. And you always try to look as though you're hurriedly and you can't stop. You don't have each. You're in a hurry. I'm an important type. I'm actually just like you are, but I'm in a hurry here now. And you try to at one and the same time show him sympathy and at the same time show him no dice. And it's that problem, you see. Well, a kid doesn't do this. Kid is deeply concerned about these things. You know, one of the cruelest men I know. I know a person who is an extremely cruel person. In some ways. There's no such thing as a totally bad or a totally cruel person, obviously. And this guy is a very cruel guy. A very cruel person. In many ways. But strange thing about him. He walks down the street, and not strange at all. We could go into chapter 17 here in the Abnormal series. He walks down the street, and all he has to do is to see a beggar on the street. And he is literally and actually in tears. He is in tears. He gives the guy some money, and he walks down the street, and you can't talk to him for 15 minutes later. And this is, again, you see, the problem. But kids don't always do this. Children have another attitude towards these things because they don't have premonitions of, well, I take this back. Children often, if I remember being a child right, now I'm not getting this from observing children. I'm getting this from observing myself as a child. I can remember at the age of 15 or 16 having fantastic premonitions of this being either me or my father or everybody I ever knew every time you'd see a beggar. Particularly you, I don't know, there's just terrible premonitions. And also, almost always, kids of 15 or 16 suspect they're not going to make 21, ever. They can't see themselves living that long. And they have great shadowy fears of death in one thing and another. And because they look at the things that the older people turn away from. They just turn away from them. They just won't concern themselves with them. Just walk around, you know, just turn away. You just won't look. Well, when I was about 8 or 9, something like that, you know how you'll get into a pattern a certain time when you will play a certain game or do a certain set of activities frantically for a while. Like make model airplanes like mad for about 6 weeks and then you quit. You just stop. And then you start doing a thing with a yo-yo. And you'll do this for about 6 weeks and then you stop. Or then you'll start reading like mad for about 8 weeks and then you stop. You know, the kids go through these cycles. Well, we went through one cycle, which I will never forget. It made a deep impression on me. I was about 8 or 9, and I would go to my cousin's house. And my cousin lived in a neighborhood in Chicago. It was on the north side, where every 15 feet there was a tavern. Every 15 feet. I mean, it was just, Chicago is the city of taverns, neighborhood taverns, you know. They really have them. And so we started this game. At about 9 o'clock at night, we would go out to just follow drunks around. Don't ask me why we did it. We did it. We would just follow them around. Just follow them and observe them. We'd follow them. And then we would come back and we would tell everybody at home. You know, they're all playing cards. Hey, we saw what the kids are starting to... And the people were always very embarrassed. Now, what are you doing that for? Now why did you have to follow Mr. Bruner like that? Now, what are you trying to do? Well, it was funny. They fell down, the guys, and then the police and the kids are telling the story, you see. Well, I never quite understood that until one Saturday night, Uncle Carl arrived at the house. He had spent his relief check in 15 minutes. And you could hear him squish. And he walked up, and being a kid, I said, Uncle Carl, what did you, why do you drink, Uncle Carl? You know, because kids always heard, you know, oh, he drinks. Why do you drink, Uncle Carl? Terrible direct action. Nobody, and awful thing. Nobody would think of asking that when you're an adult. Why do you drink? Uncle Carl looked at me for about 30 seconds, and then he said, well, I guess to wet my whistle. Which is as good an answer as any.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news. The man with the bourgeois beat, not the beatnik beat, but the bourgeois beat, Harold Everyman, Gene Shepherd. Thank you.
Hey, listen to this one, baby. Now, just a minute now. Look, I know you don't like to have the paper read to you, but I want to tell you this. Just listen for a minute. So it'll only take a second here. Now, listen. It's in today's paper. All right, I won't read the paper to you. Why do you have to make that? All right, I'll tell you. Listen, I'll tell you what it is. Now, don't take this wrong. Five-letter word? How about cigar? Stogie. Boy, listen, you're not going to get me hung up on those puzzles. I am not about to get hung up on them. You know that my old lady worked crossword puzzles, jigsaw puzzles, Chinese nail puzzles. She even tried to puzzle out my old man's life for 400 years. So you're not about... Hello. How does he work this thing? I'll let it hang there. There. There we go. Oh, boy. You don't mind if I talk to her, do you? Look, she takes garbage out, and I take garbage out. Take your own garbage out, then. If you don't want me to talk to her, that is. What a great thing. I can see this short story, baby, can't you? In true romance... I met him by the incinerator. It began every day, the man next door and me would meet next to the incinerator. He carried his garbage in a big wet bag. I carried mine in a cardboard box. Soon we were exchanging pleasantries. And of course, from then on, it was inevitable. Both of us knew. I was carrying one day a bag of coffee grounds. He helped me when it... All right, so you're right. Okay, I'll tell you what I read in the paper. You mind if I turn the record player down a little bit? Look, there is a guy out in Detroit, an automotive engineer, who invented a machine that listens to him, and he's putting it on the market. Now, here's what the story is. He said he's riding in his car one day, and he's got the radio turned on, see? He's riding in the car, and he turns the radio down, and he's mad. He's had an argument with his boss, and he starts to argue. And he finds that he's arguing with the announcer, and the poor old announcer's going along, and the guy's feeling greater and greater as he argues. And then he got the idea that what he needed was a machine to listen to him, because nobody listened to him. So he went home, and he started to work. And he's an engineer, see? Works for Detroit, you know, one of these car companies. And by the end of the month, he had him, and this is, I'm not kidding you, baby. This guy is going to put on a machine, and you're probably going to see it down at Corvettes. This guy put a machine on the market that listens, and not only listens, it reacts. And makes no editorial comment. You plug it in, you turn it on, and you sit there and you chew the fat. You sit there, you drink your beer, and you tell it the stuff. You know, all the stuff. It's coming out of you. Sometimes I feel like that's what I'm talking to here. Oh, I'm kidding. Well, anyway, this guy, he worked on this machine, and here's the way it works. Now, you interested? Well, you know the tape recorder. Well, you know that little light bulb that flickers there when you talk into it to tell us whether you're recording or not, that little orange bulb? Well, he uses two of these things as eyes in this machine. But he's got it especially set up so that the more you get heated, you know, the more you get excited, the more this thing reacts to you. And it flickers. It really does. Until finally, when you get mad enough, when you're really, really, you know, laying it down, this machine makes a humming sound that sounds sympathetic. He's got some kind of a relay in there. I'm not kidding you. That cuts in. And when you hit your point, you say, and then if you think you're going to... Then the machine goes... And the light then is steady.
And then it holds that for about 30 seconds, and then it slowly flickers off and starts to listen to you again. And you know you've hit the jackpot when this machine hums. In other words, if you don't make your point well enough, the machine never hums. Can't you see some guy? He sends this thing back to GE. He says, for 2 years I've been hollering this thing, and it hasn't said a word yet. It hasn't hummed once. Send my dough back. And they send it back, and they just say, well, you know, I'm sorry, but we said that you have to make your point. This machine does not hum unless you make your point. You haven't made your... Well, what's bugging you? Well, I just was telling you the story of this machine because I thought it was a gas, baby. That's all. I think it's a great machine. In fact, I'm thinking of sending your mother's husband one. I can think of no better, honestly, I can think of no better Christmas gift. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking of bringing one home myself, baby. Oh, come on. I mean, gee whiz. You know, the trouble with most people today, and you know, you hear this in 50 different ways every day. The trouble with most people today is that they just cannot, they do not, there is absolutely no sense of humor. I could see after you get teed off one day and you're out for a long walk. I reach in the closet and I bring out this thing, you know, and I plug it in and I'm sitting there. And you know, the sad part of it is that I bet a lot of guys are going to buy these things and find that they're happier with this machine than they are with anybody they've known for years. You know, this is why. Have you ever heard the old expression, baby, necessity is the mother of invention? Well, the reason that I'm pointing this out is that there are plenty of guys. You know, the other day, now look, don't say anything to Marge about this. You promise now? Come on. Now, I'm not kidding you. Just don't open your yap about this one. Okay? Well, the other day I'm sitting in the office and Bob comes in. Right after lunch, and I'm just sitting there kind of, you know, you get that logy, bloppy feeling after lunch. And I had been out with these guys from, oh, I don't know, you know, we went out and a bunch of guys came along, and the next thing you know, we're over in Le Marmiton on the whole business. And I came back and I'm sitting, it seems like the lunch went on for 4 hours. Oh, you know, it's getting to the point where I'm beginning to believe that all of life is a lunch with it's getting ridiculous. You know, if I figured out how much... Okay, all right. I'll stick to the subject. So, can I turn this thing down, baby, for a minute? All right. I'm not going to turn it off. So anyway, I came back after lunch. What is this? This is like a madhouse here today. What is this? Is this music you're playing or what? Who is that? He blows, man. Huh. That sounds like Nepper. Jimmy Nepper. On the trombone. Well, anyway, now look. Now let's get back to the thing here. I want you to promise me you're not going to open your mouth about this. Because there's enough trouble down at the office now anyway. And if you open your trap once, don't even suggest that you talk to me about this. Well, anyway, I came back from lunch the other day. It was last Wednesday. And I was feeling, you know, bloated and everything after lunch. And I sat around for a while. And I just couldn't get going. I'm just sitting there. And Bob came in. And he's usually one of these... There are heavy guys and light guys. You know what I mean? I don't mean in weight. There are guys who are light in the way they are towards things. You know, they just light. You know, the guys never think about anything really much. They just do things, and they buy boats, you know, and they go along, and then one day they die, and that's it. And it's not even serious when they die, you know, this kind. Just a light guy. Then there are heavy guys. Well, Bob is one of these light guys. And this is probably one of the reasons why I like to be around with him once in a while. He just doesn't think of anything. And when he does, it's always the wrong thing. The first thing he thinks of is wrong. And you know, he's one of these guys who always says, I believe in doing the first thing that comes to my mind. I'm usually right then. Oh, boy. If he ever did the first thing. He is a born committee member. Just the guy who raises his hand when the crowd raises it. He's perfect. Well, anyway, he came in. I know. Look, you're old lady. Look, you should talk about digressions, baby. Anyway, I came back and I'm sitting there waiting after lunch. Just waiting it out. When Bob came in and he had this crazy look on his face. He had the look of a heavy person on his face. And it looks terrible on the face of a light person, you know? It's like Jerry Lewis suddenly looking out from the screen and saying to you, folks, now look, about that situation in the Congo, I have a solution that involves unilateral trade agreements. I mean, just ridiculous on the guy's pan. Well, this is what happened to Bob. Bob's got this funny look on his face, and he comes sitting, flopping in. He's carrying that ridiculous briefcase he lugs around. I think he sleeps with that thing. I mean, it's poor guy's got nothing in it but three old presentations. It must be 6 years old and a rate card. And poor old guy comes lobbing in with this thing and he sits down. I think he feels naked without it. I have never seen him open it. It's just like, you know, some people got to wear a tie. Well, he's got to carry this thing in his arm or he feels like he's unarmed. So anyway, he comes in. Are you listening? Now, come on, I want you to listen because this is important because it involves... Well, you'll see. All right, later. Look, why later? Listen, I'll go down for milk later. Why must I stop in the middle of a story? I have just started to tell you the story. Well, anyway, Bob came in and he had this funny look on his face and he sat down at this chair and he sort of sideways. And it was one of those times when you got to say something to somebody. You know, have you ever been around? You know, when you sit down and somebody sits down with you and you know you've got to say something, it's just hanging in the air. It's just say something. So I said, what's the matter? What's eating you? And he turned to me. Now listen, he turned to me. And he still had this ridiculous look on his face. It was like Jerry Lewis beginning to discuss Schopenhauer, you know, that's got the crazy look. And he turns to me and he says, nothing, I feel fine. What's eating you? I said, nothing's eating me, but you came in here, what is it? There's something wrong. Now, what is it? He says, nothing is wrong. And I have never seen a guy go so out of his mind, so out of his head more in one-tenth of a second than this guy. And luckily, we were by ourselves in the office. He says to me, what do you mean there's any... What are you talking about? Are you bugging me again or what? I says, now, wait a minute. What are you... It's just easy, buddy. Now, stop it. Cut it out now. And he got up out of his chair, this little shrimp. Bob! Yeah, Bob! You know, Marge, Bob? This little ridiculous bald-headed shrimp. This guy was bald at the age of 19. This little guy gets up out of his chair. He comes over and stands over... It was like I was out of a nightmare. And he stands looking down at me and he says, what is eating you now? Let's get it out now. Just once. Let's level with each other. What have you got against me? And what have you been... What is it now? Come on. And I'm sitting there in my chair. I don't know what to say, you know? And he just stands there waiting for me to say something. I says, what is this? What are you talking about? He says, you know what I'm talking about. Bob. Yeah, Bob. That's right, Bob. You know Bob, the little thin guy, Marge? We've been up to his house a dozen times. Don't you remember anything past yesterday? Bob, yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I'm sitting there in the chair, and this little guy, this is my friend. I mean, the only guy he's a nothing, really, in a lot of ways. But he's the only guy in the office that I can stand more than 5 minutes. And he probably thinks I'm a nothing, which is probably true. But at least we've never had anything. And he is standing over me, looking down at me, and he says to me, what is eating you? And it's about time we had it out. Well, I couldn't answer him. I thought he was going to hit me. I mean, it has been since I was 10. I must have been 10 years old the last time I thought some guy was going to hit me. This little guy, Bob. And I says, what's the matter, Bob? You know, I was trying to calm him down. I said, what is the matter? Now, come on, sit down easy. He says, look, buddy, don't easy me. Don't give me this jazz about easy business. And don't treat me like I'm a kid. And he just stood there and looked. And just then, it was like out of a ridiculous TV show. Just then, the door opens, and in came Mrs. Morris. You know, the big fat one down in purchasing. She came in, and she, you know, she's one of these people. She's all bubbling and thought, you know, she's got a basket full of mail and stuff. She comes in, and she looked at us, and I know she knew something was wrong, just like that. Just like that. She stopped, and she says, are you busy here? And Bob didn't say anything, just looked at her. And I said, no, everything's fine, because I want, you know. And she came in, and she starts to do the thing with the basket. Well, Bob sat down, and after she left, no, I don't know what he was trying to say. Look, I want you to understand one thing. I am not a sorehead at the office. Every time, I'm telling you a story. I've told you exactly the way it happened. Why do you have to come back to me and then tell me I probably started it? I am entirely different, baby, entirely different at the office than I am here. Take that any way you want. Well, anyway, about 10 minutes afterwards, Bob put on his hat and left. That's all. Just walked out. Never said anything. Took his bag and left. You know, I'm going to tell you, and this is why I don't want you to open your trap. I think Marge has finally done it. You know what I'm talking about. You remember a long time ago you and I talked about this chick? At least I talked to you about her. The second time we went to her house, the first time there were 45 people there. The second time, you remember the night we went over there real late after the show? And we go out in the kitchen, me and this chick, and she's supposed to be getting the beer. And I'm supposed to be slicing the cheese. She opens up the refrigerator. She gave me a look, and I mean the look. You remember that? Now look, don't try to pretend to me that you don't remember that. And you know very well what I'm talking about. Anyway, I'm sitting there on my duff after Bob walked out and got the elevator down. You know, it's funny, when a guy like that leaves the room, it's like he's still there. Like he leaves a shadow, you know? Do you ever have the feeling when I walk out of here that I'm still here? Oh. Well, anyway, Bob leaves. And I'm sitting there thinking about this, and I finally have decided that I think she's done it. I don't know who, I don't know why, I don't know where. But I think she's done it, and I think Bob knows she's done it. And let me tell you, once a man knows that, there ain't no going back. And you know, I don't know whether or not I feel bad about it. You know, I got a feeling about that baby. It's this. You could use, you know, are you listening to me? Look, I'm not talking about us, you know. But I'm talking about everybody. I don't know what I'm trying to say. All I'm trying to say is that after he left, I began to feel worse and worse. And after work that night, you remember when I was about 2 hours late? I'll tell you where I was. I was down on the White Rose on 6th Avenue. Gin and tonic. Yeah. And it wasn't, I don't know, I can't explain it except to say that it really bothered me. It really bothered me. You know what I think bothered me about it? I think what bothered me about it most of all. Now you listen, and I don't want you to say anything to anybody about this. Now I'm serious. Don't you say anything about it. It was this. That for all the years I have known this guy, I have looked at his back now for 5 years. I knew, somehow, I knew it was going to happen. I knew it. You know, I don't know why, he's one of those guys that this happens to. And I knew it was going to happen to him. And I remember a couple of years ago, after that thing in the kitchen, I'm sitting there and I'm looking at him one day and I said to myself, I just hope he doesn't find out about it, that's all. But then I suppose, you know, it you can't help it. I'll tell you something funny about it, baby. You know, I don't know whether it works this way with chicks. Because I don't think they want to look at it. Or maybe they do, but I don't know whether it works this way with chicks. But I can tell you how it works with men. And I knew. I just knew. And I'll never forget that night. We went bowling. And I had been kidding myself for about 6 months. And we're sitting back there bowling, and she's bowling, and she comes back and sits down, and I couldn't stop it. I said, look, you know, you might as well tell me about it. And what I wanted her to say was, no, it didn't happen. Even though I knew that it did, I said, look, you might as well tell me about it. And she says, okay. And for the next 15 minutes, she told me, and I'll tell you, I blacked out 9 times during that, you know. I don't even remember what she said. All I know is that, boy, I could hear bowling pins in my head for a week afterwards. And I knew it was going to happen to this guy. Now, I don't know why this makes me feel terrible, because there's nothing I could do about it. Nothing. There's nothing I could do about it. You can't walk up to a guy and shake him and say, look, buddy, it's going to happen to you next week or maybe next year. I mean, how can you do that? And you know, I'm going to tell you something right now, baby. And this is just between you and me. I'm sitting there, and I'm drinking, and I'm talking. I'm sitting and looking and watching the ball game. I'm doing everything down at the White Rose. And suddenly, it comes to me. I wonder if some guy is looking at my back. You know, look, I don't want to get serious. I mean, I just don't want to get serious. I'll tell you. No, come on, no, none of this. Now, come on, now. You don't have to. Now, cut it out, will you? Why don't we go out for a walk? Huh? I mean, just walk. You know what I'd like to do? I would like to walk over on Park Avenue and look at the launches and the Porsches in the window, huh? You want to go? Come on. You know what I'd like to do? I would like to walk, and I would like to look up. You know that building where they've got the time on the tower up there where it says 6:38, 6:39, you know? How about you and me going down there and just watching that sign, huh? I'll tell you. A lot of times I get teed off with you, and a lot of times you get teed off with me. I will tell you one thing. Maybe that's what makes it worthwhile, you know? I'll tell you what I'll do. And then, now I'm gonna. You just sit there and listen, baby, for 1 minute. I am in charge right now. Look, I don't know what we can do about Bob. There's nothing you can do when you find out that it's happened to a guy, you know? And you know, I'll tell you another funny thing. He came back the next day, and he's got this funny look like he wants to apologize to me, and I don't know what to say to him, you know? And you know, men are funny. Men are really funny, baby. There are times when they can't say anything to one another when they know they should. And so he came in the next day, and all I wanted to say to him was, you know, Bob, I know. And I was afraid if I said that, he would know that I knew, you know? So I had to pretend I was sore, and he's pretending he's mad. And do you know that we haven't said anything for 3 days? And neither one of us is mad, and this poor guy is so sick he doesn't know which way to go. Now, all I know is that he has never said this to me, that it's happened, and I just know it has. And don't you, if you open your mouth about this, so help me, I am going to wring your neck. Because if you open your trap about this one, we are, you know? I mean, you know, I'm not kidding. Now, look. I want to get this out of my skull, so I am in control, okay? We are going down, we're going to look at the Porsches. We're going to look at the launches. You are going to look at the Mercedes with me. We are going to look up at the tower, and we're going to watch that number up there that says 1238. And when it says 1 a.m., you and I are going to come back here, okay? And on the way back, I'm going to buy 2 cheeseburgers with coleslaw. Don't give me the jazz about your diet. I don't want to hear anything. I am sick and tired up to the death of that diet. Now, you shut up for 1 minute. I am going to get 2 cheeseburgers. I'm going to get 2 great big fat kosher pickles with hair on them. I mean real smelly kosher pickles. And I'm going to buy 3 gallons of beer. And then we are going to come back here and we are going to together work that crossword puzzle. And after that, baby, we are going to swing. Okay? All right, now don't fool with your hair, nothing. You are not going to mess with your hair. You are not going to do anything. You are just going to go with me, and we are going out now. You are going to wear your glasses even, okay? I don't know what to say. If you could somehow visualize the world, if you could stand back and look at it as though you had some kind of a very special piece of equipment, a piece of equipment that would enable you to trace as, well, have you ever seen a diagram of the human nervous system? I mean, it's like a man standing there. Have you seen those glass men? Let me tell you what happened to me once when I was this little itsy-bitsy kid. I had a terribly embarrassing thing happen to me that involved a glass man. And every time I walked past these drugstores, these days where they have these plastic glass men that have all the... Speaking of plastic men, this is WOR AM at FM New York. I'm walking past these drugstores and I see these plastic men. And I'm reminded of a terrible thing that happened to me when I'm a kid. You know, I think one thing that kids have all over adults, they have the ability to become totally embarrassed. I mean so embarrassed, it's like you're going to fold up like an old nasturtium on the lapel of an ancient bum. You are just going to fade up and just die, turn inside out. And I had a terribly embarrassing moment that involved a plastic glass man. And I will describe that embarrassment. Have you ever been at the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry? This is a veritable, it's a fantasy land for a kid. They have, among other things, a coal mine right there in the middle of it. I remember one time I'm down in that coal mine, and I'm a kid. And I'm following 47 other kids from the third grade class. And these guys right ahead of me are mining coal. And they're wearing caps with lights on them, peering into the darkness. And this great big machine is sawing coal away. For over 2 years after that, every time I put a tin cap on, I imagined I had a light peering into the darkness. And I used to sit at my desk when I was about maybe 8 or 9 years old and pretend that I was sawing away at coal, little realizing that I was in the same mine. It's a different kind of a mine, but the same mine. I mean, we're way down here, all of us together, and we're getting ready to blast out. But 1 week, I'm down there with the third grade class. They used to regularly take us down there. They had one exhibit that taught me a great deal about life in general. Have you ever seen the exhibit where they have the bowling balls suspended from the ceiling? It's the transmission of energy through a solid object, I believe is what it shows. It has some kind of a very stuffy... Some kind of a very stuffy title under it like that. Botticelli's theory of the transmission of solid matter through solid things and solid energy transmitted that way through a molecular curve, ultra-oscillating circuit. And what it really amounts to is just this. You listen carefully to this. What it amounts to is about 24 bowling balls hanging from the ceiling. And boy, they have a ceiling. It's a museum ceiling. You know the kind of ceilings that are so high that you just see sort of gray clouds up there? Great big ceilings. A real museum ceiling. And so hanging from this museum ceiling, there were maybe 35 or 40 long cables, steel cables. And attached to the bottom of each cable was a bowling ball. Now, you got it? Now, these bowling balls were adjusted so that they just touched each other in a long line of bowling balls. And you were supposed to go over to the end bowling ball, the little inscription underneath it that says, now, directions for operating. Pick up the end bowling ball, move it slightly. Just go like that. Bump it up again. Just grab a hold of it and go. And sure enough, this is what happened. You'd take that one bowling ball and you'd go. You'd wait there for maybe a split second, maybe something like that. And suddenly the end bowling ball, 25 feet away, would go. Would fly out and bounce back. The end bowling ball, and none of the bowling balls in between moved. What does this mean? Think about that for a minute. This is more than bowling balls we're talking about, and certainly more than steel cables, and more than the third grade class, madam. Now, I repeat again, for the benefit of those of you who are too far back in the classroom to hear the discussion clearly. Now, look at the diagram. Bowling balls, 25, 1, 2, 3, 25 bowling balls in a row, see? Now there, you see them on the board there, 25 bowling balls. Now, I take the end bowling ball, the one over here to the left, I take it out, move it out slowly with my hands, just drop it like that. It swings, hits the bowling ball next to it, like that. Now, watch. Hey, see the end one there? See what happened there? What does this mean? What does this mean? All right, I'll tell you what it means. It means that there is no action, nowhere, any place, that does not affect all the other bowling balls, providing they touch. Now, if there was a bowling ball across the hall there just hanging by itself, it would do nothing. Well, it is an incontrovertible fact, fellow sufferers. I still can't get that fertilizer out of my mind. For the benefit of those of you who have dropped into the classroom late, and there are many. It's going to show up at the end of the semester. Have you ever had the feeling that you're arriving at the end of the semester and you've been goofing off all the time in your life, and one day somebody's going to start, time for the exam, and they're going to be passing out? Can you imagine yourself arriving at purgatory? I mean, you know, what is a purgatory? That's a good word. You arrive at purgatory, see, and there you are up there. One chute is marked in and the other chute is marked out. And you are there in the middle. You're in the basket, you see. And you're waiting there. You don't know which way you're going to go, whether you're going to go to the in chute or the out chute. And there's a girl sitting there, and she's the receptionist. And she says, Mr. Clevenger will be here in just a moment.
Oh, Mr. Clevenger. Clevenger. How did Clevenger get it? Mr. Clevenger.
Mr. Clevenger will be here in just a moment.
And you say, Clevenger.
Miss. Miss, excuse me, miss, Is this Mr. Clevenger, a thin, dark, intense man who teaches algebra? Well, yes. How did you know him? Clevenger. What does he have to do here with this this organization you have here? Remember, I'm in purgatory. What does he have to do? Well, he gives the exams. Clevenger gives the exams. And sure enough, the door opens, that great pearly door, and in steps Mr. Clevenger wearing a golden suit. Clevenger walks up to you and 300 other unfortunates who are sitting there in rows, long, suffering rows, and he begins to pass out little blue books with 12 blank pages, just lined with little blue lines. And he says, this test will consist of 10 essay questions. It will determine much about your future. Mr. Clevenger. All right, now, okay. Now, quit goofing off now, as long as we're going to talk about it. I can't forget that fertilizer thing, though. I must remind those of you who came in late that this will appear on the exam. America has gotten into a very interesting state now, where it has a deep, deep-seated nostalgia for things real. I mean, things really real. Listen carefully now. Don't lose the thread of this. We have a deep nostalgia. And one of the great plant companies out in the Middle West spent millions of dollars developing an odorless fertilizer. I mean, you know, that you put on the nasturtiums. And the pansies and the radishes. Ever tell you about the guy I knew who persisted in calling them radishes? Okay, fertilizer? Well, they found that this beautiful fertilizer of theirs did not sell very well. Just didn't make it. And they had spent millions of dollars trying to devise one that was good and was odorless, clean, beautiful, you know. And it did not work out. Nobody bought it. Until one guy in the laboratory says, aha, I have it! And sure enough, he did. He invented a synthetic barnyard aroma, which they put into the synthetic barnyard fertilizer, and now they have a real, unreal, real fertilizer. And it sells like mad. And guys spread it out there into the nasturtiums, and they breathe in deep, and they say, oh, that's real. And you know, I'd like to bring up a point about that. Since we do have a nostalgia for real things, you know that, Ralph, you go fishing. It feels great to look down there and see the real water and the real weeds, doesn't it? After Manhattan? Admit it now. Doesn't it? Of course it does. And to smell that real barnyard aroma in that real plastic fertilizer is a real satisfying thing. Well, now I'd like to make one point. You ready for it, class? I'll tell you what it is. I'm sitting there watching television, and they have hour after hour after hour after hour of one-minute commercials bespeaking the merits of various deodorants. Do you realize you could really hit the jackpot, baby, if you went the other way? Has this ever occurred to you? That the one thing that we want, you are expunging. Now, of course, it's you know, this is, I mean, we're just looking at the world the way it is. That's all. I'm not trying to editorialize at all here. Okay, you see, that it could very well be possible that you would hit the big silver jackpot if you came out with a product that did the opposite to what the deodorants do. I mean, you know? Well, I can tell you now, there's a certain truth to this, and it's inescapable. It truly is, you know. Of course, this business of the deodorants, this business of trying to escape from what we are, has very fascinating psychological ins and outs. This clean mania. Do you know that they have found that as a nation becomes more and more involved in its guilt feelings, it becomes more and more cleanliness conscious, until it arrives at a point where it does nothing but clean itself all day long in an attempt to wash away its various and or imagined sins. That in the last days of the Romans, they spent all their day in baths. They did nothing but squirt water on one another by the hour and sprinkle perfume on one another so that they would escape being what they are. It is not recorded that Genghis Khan ever took a bath or ever had any conscience at all about anything or ever once worried that he was ever doing anything wrong. He just socked people, that's all. What a jackpot. Can you think of the idea? Think of the names. Have you got any ideas for names of the product? Think of some names of the product. Woo! I mean, they would have an undeniable attraction. There's 1 minute spot that shows this girl looking out of the screen, you see. Her hair is slightly disheveled. And it ain't from the wind, baby. Her hair is slightly disheveled. And she's got a dull, sullen glow in the eye. And you see behind her, you see this kind of hazy background of her Baroque furniture in her Baroque apartment. And she just looks out at you. For maybe 40 seconds of the 60-second spot with this dull, glowing eye. And then she says, "I'm real. Are you?" Get real in the new purse-size spray plastic bottle. Discreetly become you with a vengeance. Real. Follow every bath. Of course, what real does is merely make back that lost ground that you lost in the bath. Excuse me, I digress. Oh, yes. I've always had a terrible sneaking desire to see myself as a kind of Mr. Chips. I think we all do. Sitting in my study. Have you ever thought of your declining years? Any of you really thought of your decline? I mean, really, your declining years. And if you had your choice of all things that you would like to decline as, what would you pick as your you know, just anything, some magic way you can decline in your own way? You know, I can see myself declining in a nice, unobtrusive New England college. And I'm called in a kind of a friendly way behind my back, Mr. Chips. Old J.S. Oh, I'll never forget those seminars. Of course, I'm retired now, you see, and I'm in my study, my old English study, and I could see myself always at a kind of autumn twilight. This is where I see myself. And I'm there with my ancient brocade slippers and my old stained smoking jacket. And I'm sitting there, and I'm kind of dozing off. I'm always dozing off, and there's light coming in through. Somehow, I can see stained glass. I don't know why I see stained glass there. I've never lived in a house that has stained glass. But somehow, I can see stained glass in the bay windows, orange stained glass. And it makes a kind of nice yellow light when the sun comes through, a warming light. And it's autumn. I could see myself there, and I'm a legend. I'm a legend among 30 or more classes of undergraduates who have suffered and have smiled and have won, gained, and lost at the feet of old J.S. and his seminars. And I see myself teaching something beautiful like Greek rationale philosophy, something like that. I mean, business law, oh no. I mean, something wonderful, something like romance languages, that's it. Poetry of the romance... No. How about Baroque literature? Yes, Baroque literature. And I'm known for my wonderful little side sallies. And they're collected in little thin volumes of memory. I'm sitting there, and I keep seeing this woman. I don't know who she is. She's a kind of an aunt type. She's either a wife, or else she's a housekeeper. I can't tell. And she's always tiptoeing in with a thin white plate of transparent vanilla cookies and sherry. And she comes in, and I'm dozing off there in that orange sun. And she says,
Some of the boys are here. The boys are some of the old classmen that I have taught. The boys. And sure enough, within 10 minutes, I'm kind of roused out of my dozing slumbers. I dream of past generations of classes. And I can't really, you know, I'm sitting there, and they're all gathered around, and we're talking, and we're having this one, and this wonderful, wonderful light of pure affection, and I mean pure affection, is coming out of their eyes. And I'm sitting there, and I say, "How about some sherry, boys?" And my sherry is famous. And I never, for 30 class, maybe 40 classes or more, I have never told anyone where I get this wonderful sherry. It is rumored that a duke or a lord somewhere in Spain, who once studied incognito at the college, sends it over to me every year in a little cask. Of course, I never say it's a drug, you know, the drugstore never comes into it. And I'm sitting there, and I say, "How about some of my sherry?" And they lighten and brighten up, and, Matilda, some cookies for the boys. And she says, "I've already anticipated that." And you can just smell that wonderful warm smell of the kitchen. She's been baking cookies for them to come. And she passes among them these hot cookies, and the Chris says, "Now it's hot, boys. You know that and the boys all sit, and then I begin to tell stories. And the light is growing dim, and somehow now I see a fireplace beginning to glow. And I can feel the warmth of the sherry. And Matilda brings a wrap in. I've never worn a wrap in my life. I don't know what a wrap is. But she has this wrap that she brings in. And it's soft and woolly. And she says, "Put this around your shoulders." And she puts it around my shoulders. And I say, "Oh, come on now. I'm feeling fine." And I push the wrap away. And I load up my pipe. And I begin to tell stories. Isn't that a fantastic picture? I've done it 3 times, Phil. I'm now going to do it again. Speaking of fantastic pictures, this is WORAM and FM New York. Oh, the mundane world. There is not a single inch, not a single square inch of stained glass to be found in this whole miserable station. Not one. Why do I see myself declining that way when it's obviously, you know? Then again, on the other hand, I can see myself. But what, you see? I learned about it from the bowling balls. I learned that you drop that one bowling ball at the end, that one bowling ball at the end, that other one way down, 25 bowling balls from the end goes, just pops out like that. So there's no escaping. It's not going to be so simple, you know. Not so simple, baby. Now look. I suppose some of you wonder. There. No, we don't need this. I suppose some of you wonder why I have called you here. I had this said to me the other day. I get into this elevator. Now, all I'm talking about here, if you listen carefully, is Mr. Chip's bowling balls, odorless, fertilizer, and real. That will bring out the true photographic honesty of your own soul. I'm standing in this elevator, one of these stainless steel elevators that rise and fall here, rise and fall in these buildings, up and down. The Seagram building, stainless steel elevators with the hum of Muzak music playing behind you, a kind of limbo. And this elevator operator is standing there, and he pushes the button, and he turns around. He looks at an assembled group of solid-looking men, all wash-and-wear souls, wash-and-wear lives, wash-and-wear sins, all of them standing there carrying their wash-and-wear briefcases, looking to the front with that elevator look. The guy turns around, and he says, "Suppose you wonder why I've called all of you here. For this meeting." And it didn't go over. Not a single man laughed. Not a single wash and wear soul even snickered. And he turned back to his buttons and didn't say anything. I felt terrible. I didn't know whether I should just give him a courtesy laugh. In the end, I chickened out. I didn't do anything. I stood there and glowered like the rest. I
arrived at the 23rd floor, and I got out so fast, I didn't even look at his face. I didn't look at anything. We just stopped, and I scurried out. The door slammed behind me, and I thought, I'm out again. Well, someday, of course, as inconsequential as it seems, all of these bowling balls, all of them bumping together, I'm going to throw that last one out again. It's like the guy that I met one time, who was a dog race fan. Did I tell you about the guy I met who was a nut on dog races? He used to call them the Dugs.
Really? Go to see the Dugs.
You learn a lot when you go down to see the Dugs, you know. I'll tell you about the time I went to see the Dugs. And the Dugs were racing with monkeys on their backs. I'd ever tell you about the monkey Dug race? Well, I'm going to tell you again because it means something this time. They had the big special race in which the Dugs were loaded with monkeys. They put a monkey on the back of each dog. And then they started the electrical rabbit, and immediately the monkeys are underneath the dogs hanging out for dear life. The dogs are running for dear life, and the rabbit itself is even scared. You can applaud. It was a fantastic sight, because the instant I saw this conglomeration of movement go roaring off down the track away from me, I knew that I was seeing the truth about my life. Am I a dog or am I a monkey? Or am I an electrical rabbit? Which, I have no idea. All I know is that the dogs wanted to catch the rabbit, the rabbit wanted to stay away from the dogs, and the monkeys wanted to hang on. Which are you in the vast dog race of mankind? A dog, a monkey, or a rabbit? Which are you? I suspect the rabbit itself is that confounded it, that sinister mirage that we're all chasing. How is it going, Mac? It what? What is it? Where, huh? Is that ridiculous electronic rabbit, huh? It? Yeah, that's it. So we can eliminate the electronic rabbit, right? None of us are rabbits in this game of life, right? Okay. Now, let's take the pure physical side of it. Who is chasing that rabbit faster, the dog or the monkey hanging on his back? Which, on the other hand, has the most control over the situation, the dog or the monkey? I don't know. But then, on the other hand, who is it? Now, wait a minute here. Look, you're not going to tell me that it's less important than that, are you? You're not going to try to duck out on it again, are you? Well, okay. I'm sitting there watching the duck race, and this guy sitting next to me is really digging this. I mean, he's one of the few guys I know who really dig the dugs. Dogs. And I'm sitting there next to him, trying to understand what he was understanding. And then he began to understand that I wasn't digging what he was digging, the dugs. He called them the dugs. I mean, dugs. And then I said to him, "This frightens me." I had to say it. And he turned to me, and I could see in his eyes that I had struck a chord, that somehow he was frightened too. We just both sat there and watched. Incidentally, I won $16 on that race. I bet on a short, fat monkey wearing a red jacket. I bet on the monkey, not the dogs. He was the scaredest-looking monkey I ever saw, and I only bet on him because he was a long shot. He had that sad look in the eye of an eternal long shot. Have you ever had the feeling that you are in a horse race and that you're a selling plater? And that there are other guys running in this race that are favorites, shoe-in favorites, and you've just been put in to round out the field? And it's a handicap race, and you're liable to be sold at auction immediately after the running? Or maybe somebody's... Oh, no, this is not a fixed race I'm running. No, this is a fair race I'm running. I mean, I got just as much chance as the best. And so I see myself with that beautiful orange, that light coming in. That's what we need. Wild, screaming applause. And just, no, there we go. A little touch. You know, you're aware, of course, that there is an artistic principle that has been pursued by artists for centuries. And it's a principle of what they call divine imperfection. Do you know what is it, divine imperfection? Well, you can construct mathematical beauty. I mean, the Greeks had a business with the golden mean and the formula for beauty and all this stuff. But they always, in the middle of every beautiful epic that they created, they would stick one thing of outstanding ugliness. Because then it tied all of it together, you know. All of it. All of it. No one knows really why this is. Yin and yang could be. No one knows, but this is a true fact. One thing. That was the principle, you know, of the beauty mark. Are you aware of that? The imperfection. That mark of seeming imperfection on the cold, glazed face of beauty. And then it made it beautiful instead of just perfect. All right. Are you ready for that mark? All right.
Drive with confidence on General Tires. You don't take a chance with General Tires. You can drive anywhere with never a care. Cause you know you're General Tires. We'll get you there. General's line of tires leads all the rest. Costs a little more and you get the best. Your driving days will be worry-free. Drive with confidence on General Tires.
Only $2 more than the lowest priced ordinary tires gives you all these extra values of famous General Safety Milers. Rugged 7-rib tread, shock absorber construction, extra mileage, recapability. See your General Tire dealer today for the easiest terms in town.
There, now don't you feel better? A moment of realism in a life there are many moments of realism. I it comes out occasionally in the Times. Funny thing. I hope somebody, somewhere, someplace. Excuse me for a minute. I digress here. Do you remember the Collier brothers? Do you remember them? With their terrible mess of a place? You know, I keep thinking of a cartoon of the Collier brothers, and somebody's called, you know, somebody's come to visit them, and one of them says to the guy, the house is a mess. But, excuse me, I just can't help it. But the Collier brothers, one of the reasons the Collier brothers attract and interest and intrigue people so much is that, have you ever felt the very, very sneaking and very, it's a thing you try to push out of your mind, the sneaking feeling that you have within you, the little strain of a Collier brother in you? Everybody wants to hide. Do you know what hibernation is? Hibernation? Everybody wants to hide somehow, somewhere, some way, and lock the doors and stock up a place with canned goods and completely shut it all out. I one time met a guy. It's the strangest man I ever met in my life. And it had caused all sorts of repercussions in his life. And he was well up in years when I met him. You might have read the story. Well, I met this guy, an intriguing character, that at about the time of World War I, he was just a young guy, a very sort of weak person, obviously. And his mother was a fantastic battle axe, one of these really tough, strong, hard people. And the father was dead. And so the war came along, World War I, and she decided he wasn't going to the army. And she decided the way he wasn't going to the army was that she was going to lock him in the closet. And that would prevent him from going to the army. Well, it did. She locked him in the closet, and he veritably disappeared from the face of the earth. For 25 years, this guy stayed in that closet. Believe it or not. And she used to feed him through a little slot that she had built. She had one of these trap doors that go up, and it was one of these unfinished closets. They didn't even finish the closet. And she'd feed him up through the trap door. She would put a little plate of something, and he would peer down once in a while. Summer, winter, year after year, age after age, eon after eon passed, and this guy crouched in the closet. Until it got to the point where his only life was a closet life. And then came the most dramatic moment of all, when the old lady died, and there was nobody to feed him. And he was afraid to go out of the closet, because after 25 years in the closet, it was the only possibility that he had was closet world and closet life. He couldn't possibly go out. And he stayed in there, and he began to starve. He began to grow thin and white. Terrible, terrible thing. Until one day, somebody came, and they were going to clean out the house. The estate had been settled, and was it assumed that this son had died 25 years before. And they were cleaning out the house, and he heard them down there. And he was terrified, because in 25 years, his mother had allowed no one ever to enter the house. And he didn't even know that his mother had died. All he knew was that she didn't come anymore. And then finally, somebody raised that trapdoor. And they threw it back, and they looked down to the guy below and said, "Hey, there's nothing but junk up here. Boy, is this place loaded with junk." And he was cowering behind a pile of old rags, papers, countless bottles and things that had formed his nest. He made a nest up there. A big bird's nest, literally, actually a bird's nest, that he lived in. Papers, cans, millions and millions of things, all piled up. And the man crawled up through the trap door, flashed his flashlight around. This man had not had a light in his nest for 25 years. He crawled over the parapet to see where it ended, and he saw cowering down there this thing. He says, "There's some kind of an animal here." It scared the daylights out of him. And he darted back, and they closed the thing up. They thought there was an animal, some kind of a big possum or something there. Which he almost was. His hair hung down to his waist. And three or four men came back, and they came back with fire extinguishers. Somehow they felt they could squirt whatever it was. And they turned on those flashlights again, and by now he had darted all the way back to the corner. He didn't know what they were. They seemed to be animals to him. All he had seen for 25 years was the hand of this person giving him this tray of food. And the two of them, the group of men and this thing, stood there for... And suddenly one of them said, "It's a man! God, it's a man!" And he couldn't talk. His mother had not talked to him in 25 years. He had lost the power of speech. And they just stood there in the dark with their flashlights. Just stood there. And all he could do was make these funny sounds. And they didn't know what to do. He was a total and complete, thorough monster that had no connection with any known life that anyone had ever lived. And he just stood in the corner. And that actually is the end of the story. That really is the end of the story. There's not much you can say, actually, about it after that. Not much you can say. Oh, it's a tangled web we weave. A tangled web. And there are many of us hiding in corners, looking with cold, dark eyes at strange,
menacing creatures creeping up on us. No comprehension, no contact, no world. Surrounded by the artifacts of our past existence. Empty cans with Campbell's soup kits inscribed on them. Old headlines, millions of them, in our minds. Ancient torn photographs. Archaic. And yet somehow meaningful, but only to us. And he crouched in his corner, just as many of us, maybe all of us, crouch in the corner. All of mankind, watching some creeping thing with a flashlight coming and looking for us. Coming out through that trapdoor. Did you hear that flute? I'm going to tell you something about that flute. I never talk about the music I use. I'll tell you something about that flute. You're hearing the sound. Set it back, Ralph. I'll tell you when. That flute has a very interesting symbolic meaning for all of us. Did I ever tell you the story of the anthropologist that I knew who went into the headwaters of the Orinoco, and he found this tribe, and this tribe had a form of music, a kind of music that could kill, actually kill. And that upon one hearing, even if you heard it from a 40-mile distance, you were doomed. Actually doomed. And it worked. He saw this working. But it didn't kill him. It killed members of the tribe. And the musician who played it died after he played it. They had a strange system of notation. And the man who played this flute, it was a flute that was the flute of death. It is literally and very liberally translated. It didn't really say that. It said something like the flute of eternity and fear and death. And this flute was kept in the chief's hut. And whenever the time came for the ceremony of redemption, the ceremony of contact with the gods, this flute was taken out. And the young man who had been trained to play this flute, not this actual flute, but other flutes like it, who had been trained to play this flute and this particular piece of music, would be summoned before the assembled members of the tribe. And he would be given the flute. And also, at the same time, the highest honors of the tribe. And then the man who was to be really honored for that year crouched down next to him. And the two of them were left alone in the camp. And all the rest of the tribe, for day after day, 7 days they would march through the jungle to get away so that they couldn't hear the sound of this music. And upon the dawn of the seventh day, after they had marched into the jungle, the man with the flute would begin at dawn to play the music of death, redemption, and fear. And then, on the noontime of that day, the tribe would begin to march back. Silently, this was part of the ceremony, they never entered one moment of speech or conversation, not a sound, both directions. And when they arrived back in the clearing, the two men would be lying
with their arms folded, dead, with the flute between them. Now, you see, this is a very interesting symbolic story for all of us. Because each one of us suspects somewhere, someplace, somewhere along the line, there is something, some bugle that's going to blow. I heard this story of a man who said, he says, you know, I arrived at this place one day, and I suspected something was there. And I left. I had a terrible fear inside of me. I said, what was it? I always have a terrible fear in me. He said, I don't know. It wasn't Santa Claus. What do you think it was? Oh, maybe death. Oh, come on. Come on, Charlie. What are you... Oh, come on. Yeah. Oh, come on. What are you giving me? Yeah. Oh, come on. And I sat there looking into the bottom of my Pepsi-Cola bottle, my sociable Pepsi. And he looked into the bottom of his sociable Pepsi-Cola bottle. And we said no more. Now, I'm going to tell you something about this flute. This actual flute. This is the flute, and this is the song. This is an anthropological record. This particular flute and this particular piece of music is being played by an ancient, very ancient woman, who is one of the last members of a Borneo tribe who remembers the days of the killing flute music. That since the civilization has come to many areas of Borneo, the tribal beliefs have slowly sloughed off one by one until only a very few very old people remember them. And this is a recording of a Borneo woman who was about 90 years old, who is now dead, by the way. This was recorded 6 years ago, playing a flute about 200 years old, was the estimate made, a flute that is a flute of death, and playing music of redemption and death of the Borneo tribes. A very, very rare recording. And this is the actual thing. That's for all the gang out at Pinky's, where they're having a pajama party tonight. All the kids from Woodbridge High School. Speaking of redemption and death, this is WOR AM and FM New York. I'm sure I'll have to answer for this one day. That's a legitimate recording, and Wouldn't it be terrible if suddenly the tickers start roaring and it says 17,000 people die in New York of mysterious malady? Radio man sought? You know, you can't. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. Speaking of mysterious maladies, we have with us tonight the Village Voice, which is a mysterious malady of our time. And the Voice is celebrating a lot of things, and the most important thing that they're celebrating right now is that they're moving into a new office. It's a funny thing. I'll tell you this about the Voice. I feel, since it's getting to be autumn now. I mean, doesn't it frighten you a little bit? Don't you feel just a little trepidation? It's always getting to be autumn, or getting to be spring, or getting to be winter. Or it's always just about Tuesday. It always just was Wednesday. How do you picture time? I mean, how do you picture your life? Is it a circular track, or is it a... What is it, you know? Or have you ever seen a picture? I remember one time looking at a movie that was shot. And it was shot for a class in psychology. It was a series of psychological experiences. Have you ever looked at a psychology film of psychological experiments? The very most famous one, of course, is The Monkey and the Stick and the Box. But I think these would make great films if they ever put them into the movie houses. But there was one of a squirrel in a revolving cage, a squirrel in a race. And this squirrel was in this cage, you see, and he was running. And the cage was going around, one of these revolving things, and the old squirrel was running. He was galloping like mad. And as he galloped, from time to time, they would blow a little whistle. They would take him out of his cage, and they would give him something to eat. Well, then they'd stick him back in the cage. And then, of course, what he did after he got back in the cage was he sat on his duff. He wanted more food. He didn't want this running jazz. He wanted food, you know. Well, they kept this up for a while until he finally got the idea that if he ran, he would get food. Well, then they reversed the thing on him. They stuck him in the cage one day, and every time he would run, you see, it's fantastic to see him run. He would go, his feet would go like, his little old tail hanging up over his, he would run. And he had this wonderful, happy account executive look on his face. He looked like every guy I've ever known who worked for Benton and Bowles, running after that new account. He's running like mad. He's got this happy look like he's discovered the key. Well, then they would go, boop, and he would slow down, and they would take him out. They'd hand him a little chunk of cheese or whatever it was, and he'd get this happy look on his face. They'd stick him back in the cage, and then he would start running again. Boop. They'd slow down, he'd look happy, and they'd give him another piece of cheese. Well, this kept up for a couple of weeks, you see. They were euchering him, and to use a phrase and to coin a bad one, they were mouse-trapping him. He kept doing this until finally one day, he's running along. They didn't blow the whistle. And he kept looking over his shoulder. And he'd run and run and run, and now he's starting to get a Charlie horse, you know? And finally the guy goes, boop, and the squirrel says, oh, wow, it's about time. Oh, boy, what a sweat. Whew! He sits down on his duff with that happy look on his face, you know, the kind of look that, well, at last. Nothing happened. They gave him nothing to eat. He looks out of the cage, and then he's got this funny look on his face. The kind of look that says, well, come on now. Well, let's cut out the kid in here. Let's cut out the jazz. And they don't do anything. So slowly it dawned on the squirrel. He turns around and he starts to run again. He figures that he hadn't run hard enough. He's running like a madman now. Boy, I'm sweat is pouring down, his eyeballs are bulging out, and his Charlie horse is like a basketball hanging on him. He's and he keeps looking back frantically over his shoulder. Finally, after he is almost at the point of it, they go, boop. Oh,
Now, come on, fellas, please. He's looking out. No cheese, N-O. He sits there for about 10 minutes. He gets up and he slowly starts to run, this time very slowly. He's all pooped out. Then they go, and then he sits down and says, oh, I see, they wanted me to slow up. Why didn't they tell me? Then they go, boop, boop. He's not doing anything, he's just sitting. Boop. Still no food. Boop, boop, boop. He says, I'm not running the whistle. Boop. Then he starts to run fast again. And then they start blowing the whistle continually. Boop. He stops. Now, wait a minute. Boop, boop. Finally, do you know what that squirrel did? No. He just lay down and he cried. They blew the whistle at him twice. He's crying. Once in a while, his little paw would try to run all by itself. He's lying there crying. And then he begins to beg. Please, I can't. And then he got up. I'll never forget this. He got up and he started to run. This time he ran with purpose. He ran. They blew the whistle. He's running like a fiend now. His last gasp. He does not turn around. Now they brought out a whole plate of cheese. They want to stuff it. Oh. And he fell to the bottom of the cage, dead of a heart attack. Well. Yes, sir, that's my baby. No, sir, don't mean maybe. I mean, I think that would look nice right after, a Jerry Lewis picture. You know what I'd like to show that at? Wouldn't that be a fantastic film to show at a sales meeting? Right after you show this big industrial film about what a wonderful place it is you work in. You know, it opens up with We Are Wonderful music. Bum, 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 bum. And then the voice comes in, the romance of bum, 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 bum. Blackboard erasers. Bum, 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 bum. And all the blackboard eraser salesmen sit there and they just feel, you know, it's important to be dedicated to something real. Bum, 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 bum. And then as the last notes die away, when the trumpets are rising, you know, and the picture of the founder is rising up into those heavenly clouds at the end, where it says the end, the boss stands up and he says, fellas, we have a little special added attraction. For those of you who are animal lovers today, you might find this to be kind of fun. And on comes our friend, the S-Q-U-I-R-L, the squirrel. Everybody looks, they all got that funny look on their faces. What's the matter? You want me to bring the squirrel back for a reprieve? There he is, he's alive. I'm not fooling any of you. He's dead, D-E-D, isn't he? And who did it? Was it the squirrels that did it or was it us? Speaking of squirrels, we have with us the Village Voice tonight. And for those of you who have been threatening to fall in line, for those of you who have been threatening to subscribe to the Village Voice, all I can say is, come on, you know, this is getting pretty ridiculous. I mean, after all, but the thing that I would like to say about the Voice is, many, of course, but one of them is the thing that was said to me by a guy who runs another newspaper and a very important one here in town. And we were sitting down, we were having lunch. He's a publisher. He publishes one of the big morning papers here in New York. And he says, you know, I hear you talk about The Voice. He says, I always get it. Do you know that every newspaper in the country now gets The Voice?
every newspaper in the country. I'm talking about the regular dailies and weeklies in America get the Voice. It's a funny thing. But he said, you know, he says, I'll tell you one thing about the Voice. He says, these guys really have guts. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he says, you know, I don't know whether I would ever even dream of starting a newspaper these days. He says, this is an impossible thing today. I said, well, you know, have you ever thought about your own career? Have you ever thought, would you have the guts to start it all over again? To start doing it again? Knowing what you know now? You know, really, do you think you would do it? I one time I was sitting with a guy who was a tired doctor, and he had studied maybe 12 years, and finally he began to practice, and one thing and another. You know, there's a funny thing. Some people get official, and others don't. Some make it, and some don't. And I'm not talking about money. Some guys secretly suddenly realize that they haven't made it, that they are not good at what they think they're good at. It's a terrible realization to make, you know? It's an awful thing for an outfielder standing up there at the plate, and he suddenly realizes he's a 230 hitter. And it's not that he's in a slump. He's just a 230 hitter. And to follow a guy who's a 270 hitter, who follows a guy who's a 310 hitter, who follows a guy who's a 350 hitter. And to just get up and say, I am a 230 hitter. Now, let's see. I've gone 0 for 12. Now, I am due. Oh, boy. That's terrible. Well, this doctor I knew had gone 0 for 37. And for 30-some years, he had been a doctor. And he just didn't make it, never. He wasn't a good doctor. And he knew it. And everybody else did, which made it even worse. A very sad thing. And so we're sitting around, and we started to talk about courage. And that's a terrible thing to talk about sometimes. And he didn't say much. He just sat there. We talked. About six of us sitting around chewing the fat. And we're leaving. He has not said a word. He says, this is on me. And he bought dinner for about six guys, which was very embarrassing because he probably didn't have enough dinner money there for six more, his total life savings. But he bought. So he insisted. So we're walking down the street, and one by one we peel off, going our ways, until finally I'm left with another guy I knew who also realized this about this guy. And we walk about two blocks. We did, you know, there's a terrible feeling. We knew what we were going to say and what we were going to talk about, but neither one of us wanted to. And we walked along, and we're scratching and talking and fooling around, and suddenly it came out. He says to me, the guy, he says, you know, boy. I said, yeah, boy. He says, you know? I says, yeah, I know. We walk another 60 feet. And I think it simultaneously occurred to us that it takes at least 50 times more courage to be a failure than to be a success. You know that? It really does. And I don't mean the gallant type failure. I mean, it takes real guts to be a failure. I mean, real guts. It doesn't take any guts to be a 350 hitter. It takes a good eye. It really does, you know, and good reflexes. It takes real guts to have a bad eye and bad reflexes and still put the suit on. Believe me. And we just walked along. I don't know where this guy is, this doctor, now. It doesn't make any difference, you know. He will eternally be what he is. Even after he'll have an unsuccessful tombstone. Doesn't quite make it. It's just that way. And so this publisher talking to me, he says, you know, these guys have real guts, genuine guts, and I'm not paralleling at all with that. But I don't know. You know, Ed Fancher said something to me a month or so ago. We're sitting in the H&H, and we're knocking down a lamb sandwich with mint on the side. I said, Ed, it is now almost 5 years since you did it. He says, yep. His beard waggling. I said, Ed, would you do it again? Nope. I said, but, you know, people read The Voice now. I mean, you really are swinging. So I couldn't do it again. I said, well, Ed, now that brings up an interesting point. If you knew what was in, you know, if you had known what was in store for you, would you have done it 5 years ago? He says, are you kidding? Absolutely not. And I remember just 4 years ago in August, walking down MacDougall Street with Ed Fancher, with Danny List. Let's see who... No, Dan was not with us that night. It was Ed, it was Jerry Talmer, and Dan Wolfe. Ed Fancher is the publisher of The Voice. Jerry Talmer is the editor. He also is... He's one of the editors. He's also the drama critic for them. And Dan Wolfe is the editor. And we're walking down the street, and we had had dinner someplace, a real late dinner. And this was back in the days when I was on all night, and I was getting ready to come into... I was working 7 nights a week, and I was out of my head probably 3 nights out of the 7 with work. Have you ever worked so hard you can't see straight? I mean, literally, can't see straight. Well, that's what... I was working all the time. I just like... All the time. And you know what you do when you develop... When you work at something that requires intense concentration, like this, for example... when you work hard and long, you begin to develop a complete looseness and freedom that you can never develop unless you really do work hard and long. You know what I mean? It's like if you fly a lot hard, you get so that you're a great flyer, you know? You don't even think about it. It just comes naturally. Well, I have been working, and I'm getting ready to come into the station. And it's hot. Oh, boy, the city is sitting on us in the heat. Guys are hanging from the fire escapes, and we're walking along MacDougall Street, and it's dark. And the paper has not been able to turn out a... How many of you remember The Voice when they couldn't even afford to turn out a summer edition? You don't remember that? Well, I was involved. They could not afford to turn out their paper during the summer. And Ed said, and I will remember this for as long as I live, because I think The Voice... 40 years from now, is going to be a historic little paper. I believe that they will be paying $5 a copy for copies of really collector item voices that go back to those days when Norman Mailer was writing red-hot, steaming stuff in it, when all of us were writing these wild things and struggling away. And Ed said, and this was 4 years ago, this, by the way, this was before I even had 3 listeners. I couldn't rub 2 listeners together. Get them to even know my name. And I'm walking along, and Ed says, I don't think we're going to be able to open up again. He just dropped it like that, right in the middle of us. And Ed was the guy that was, you know, he was the publisher. And not much was said. You can't argue, you know. We walked a couple of blocks. And I said, well, I got to go now. Because this was like somebody has just said, well, it's dead now. Too bad, we're sinking. What do you do then? You know, you just, well, okay. So I got in the car. I had an ancient used car that weighed 9 million pounds and mounted twin 50s on the hood. It was so old. I got in this thing, and I lumbered off. You know, I was so poor in those days that my car was running on willpower. It refused to die. The car sensed what was going on. And you know that for over 3 months, that car didn't use a drop of gasoline. Now, I call that real loyalty. It's funny how you get involved. So I'm walking along, and I get in the car, and I go. And before I go, Ed says, well, he says, why don't you call tomorrow? I said, okay. So the next morning, I called. After working, I was bleary-eyed. And I finished, and I called Ed, and we got together, and it was breakfast. And Ed and Dan and these guys had been up all night doing something, setting the paper by their teeth or something. This is literally what happened. So I met Ed, and the next morning, and Ed said, well, he says, I've got $200 that I was going to save. He said, because when this thing goes under, I am dead, and I'm going to have something to eat on. He said, I'm going to spend the $200. I said, what are you going to buy with $200? What can you do? He says, well, I can pay the guys. And Ed Fancher paid these guys because nobody had any money for 4 months. He went around and he gave all the guys $30 until he had no more money. That is exactly what happened 4 years ago this month. Are you interested in that? And this was long before Pfeiffer even heard of The Voice. I'll point that out. You know that Pfeiffer heard of the Village Voice over this show? Interestingly enough. If you're getting into the background now, the Village Voice, you might be. And they used to have a different heading. In those days, there was a kind of solid block against the Voice. They couldn't give the paper away. And I'd like to. One of the most interesting things about the Village Voice was that Norman Mailer, one of America's probably top 10 novelists of the past 20 years, used to go out on Wednesday night in a truck and deliver the paper by hand to the news guys who didn't want it by hand. And every newsstand he would come to, they would have a hand-to-hand combat. I don't want that paper! Get that rag out of here! And Mailer would wrestle with him and fist fight, yell, the cops would come, and finally he would load the Voice back in the car and drive to the next one. He was successful about one out of 25 would carry the paper at all, and only then free. You get no money back. This is a fact. Well, all of you know now that the Village Voice is one of the most successful papers of ideas in the country. And I'd like to say this, that I'm very proud of my connection with them. Very, very proud. You know, funny thing now, what's happened, I go into The Voice once in a while, there's a whole bunch of people in there that I don't know, and they don't know me. And they think I'm just this guy that does his thing on the radio. And there's the thing about hip-type people. They think that anybody who doesn't work in the accepted mediums is there's something very square about him. But my medium, unfortunately, my medium is the most out of all, actually. If you call unaccepted out, Daddy, how far out can you get? And so I walk in The Voice once in a while, and these faces look, and I go back to Fancher once in a while and sit there, and I say, Ed, have you stopped smoking cigars yet? For 4 years, he has fought a losing battle with cigars. He says, well, yeah, actually, I'm going to have my second one right now. What a liar. Completely lie. And so we sit there and we each smoke a cigar, and that's it. So that's the story of The Voice. And if you would like, and I hate to put a commercial after this, because it really isn't, you know, I'm just telling you the facts of it. And The Village Voice is a paper that is published here in New York, and there's an odd kind of humanity that runs through it. It has all the schizoid problems that everybody has. And it does not present a monolithic front to the world the way most newspapers do. It's very vulnerable. It's one of the few newspapers I've ever seen that is chronically embarrassed. It really is. And if you would like to subscribe to the paper, the petty cash editor is now on duty. And I'd like to make another point. Do you know that Ed Fancher, and I'm going to say another thing I probably shouldn't say, that over 3 years went by before Ed could even draw the minimal salary. And you know that when they passed the minimum wage law, Fancher was breaking the law every week with himself and still is not law-abiding? I mean, it must be rotten to be a boss. Unless you're really making, you watch, when they finally make it big, time will buy him out. And Fancher will be farmed out to some place up in Jupip. It's a great paper, and I'm proud to have been involved in it. And if you would like to call, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll repeat the offer again. They pay, you know, they pay the cost of a phone call. It costs $3 a year, and I'll guarantee you personally, if after 6 weeks you're not hooked on this paper, they will gladly cancel your money and send you back the whole business, you know? In fact, they have been known to do it after the guy has gotten 11 months out of the 12. And there are such freebies around. You know, there's one priest in town, which I will not mention. This priest said that he has had three separate one-year subscriptions to The Voice, and every time he gets mad. And then after he's left it for 2 weeks, he's got to go back and get it again. He misses being mad, apparently. I mean, you got to have something that you have to... But if you would like to subscribe to the paper, they will pay the cost of a collect phone call. So you call them at Gramercy 3. Now, wait a minute. No, this is their new number, so don't look up. I will not give you their new number yet. Use their old number. It's Watkins 44669 in New York. Watkins 44669 here in New York. Now, this is the thing I'm going to add. Last 2 weeks ago, do you remember we asked for the furthest away call? You know where it was? It was Houghton, Michigan. Some listener, do you know where Houghton is? Houghton is way up near the Straits of Mackinac. Way up there. Some poor beleaguered listener up there picking us up with 4,000 miles of copper wire and a 28-tube receiver and a pair of cans is trying to get... he's reaching, grasping for it. And he pretends that he's living in the middle of the village in Houghton, Michigan. And so he is the guy that got the free subscription. And The Voice will do this, that the furthest away call, and I'm doing it at this time, it's now 1:03, because we must be getting tremendous coverage at this hour. The furthest away call will get a free subscription to The Voice, and they level. No kidding. They got one from Maine. They got one from... Florida, but the furthest away was Houghton, Michigan last week. It's way up there. I used to spend hours on Houghton Lake, ceaselessly fishing for smallmouth and northern pike. But the number again is Watkins 44669 in New York. Now look, the thing to do, I mean, for God's sakes, don't panic. I mean, don't panic. Very shortly, it will be Wednesday. Easy. I mean, that goes up easy. Very shortly, it will be Wednesday. And then it will be Friday. You see, it's like... Well, I can't tell you what he said. Because I can't tell you. I mean, this guy sat in that corner, and I asked him, what did you think when those strange things came in? I couldn't tell either. Now, all you got to do is to grab the end bowling ball. No, the actual secret of it is that you can't let go of the end bowling ball because you are the end bowling ball. Look, we're all too young to go, you know? I mean, we're all too young to go. It's too soon to cut it off. I mean, we've got many more things to do. We got it all before us. I mean, we're just getting to the point. Now, come on, all together now. All together now. We'll get this thing to the top or it's going to kill us all. Here it comes back down again.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news. You are tuned to WOR 710. And WOR FM New York.